public opinion increasingly assumes a greater role in trying to gauge public opinion and ultimately what is the will of the Mexican people. The election, as you, all of you know, is quite a close margin election. There are subtle nuances and differences between the different polls, and I thought it would be interesting to have a session with some of Mexico's most renowned pollsters, and just to not just look at the numbers that each of them have in trying to measure the election, 39 days before the election, but also to get their own perspectives. Several of them are not just pollsters, but actually are also political scientists. So I think it's going to be a mixture of numbers and analysis and their own perspectives. I think it's going to be a fun event. I would have loved to have had this in a round table discussion for it to be more interactive than this kind of a format, which I think takes a little bit away from it being interactive. But I'm going to do my best to not only keep them from going at each other, but also from engaging you and having this be as interactive as possible. We appreciate the fact that there are a lot of knowledgeable people in the audience and that either have interesting things to say themselves or interesting questions to pose. The way it's going to work out is each of them is going to make a presentation. I've asked them to make a presentation between 15, 20 minutes, no later than that, as brief as possible to kind of at least set the context, and then we're going to open it up for discussion among themselves, and then I'm going to open it up to the audience, and I would encourage you to participate in the discussion. You all have their bios, so I'm not going to make a very lengthy introduction, but we're going to start off at my very far end to the right with Paco Abundis. Francisco Abundis is the Associate Director at Parametría, a good friend, previously at CIDE and ITAM. Then to his left, we have Ulises Beltran, who is the Principal Partner and President of the consulting firm BGC. I thought he was an interesting person to have because, as you can see from his bio, he's been, to some extent, the director of public opinion research for two consecutive administrations, Salinas and Cedillo. And so not only does he have the perspective from a public opinion standpoint, but he has a wealth of experience from someone that has seen it from the inside of a presidential office. Jorge Buendía, who is the managing director of Ipsos Public Affairs, also has been at CIDE and ITAM. You'll notice that there's a University of Connecticut and University of Chicago mafia here at the podium. That was not on purpose. Roy Campos, who is the general director of Consulta Mitofsky. I didn't know this, Roy, but he was the poll director at INEGI for over eight years, also highly regarded. And to my immediate right, Rafael Jimenez, who's the general director for ARCOP, which is Análisis de Resultados de Comunicación y Opinión Pública. Rafael, if I'm not mistaken, is probably the only one here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I know that you're the pollster for the PAN, for Felipe Calderón. I don't think the others have a partisan affiliation with any of the candidates, although they have done work for the parties in the past. But I thought it would be interesting to kind of get, when I structured this event, I tried to get a wide representation of pollsters and viewpoints. So with that, Paco, why don't we start with you?
Okay. Good morning. Thank you for coming. Thank you for the invitation to Armand Pechard and CSIS. to have the opportunity to present part of what we consider, I think, a complicated election. And I hope that we don't repeat ourselves too much because we are all pollsters, but I think we have complementary explanations for what's going on now in Mexico. First, I want to show you this chart. It's a 2 years time series where we can see the different events of this election. So certainly, this election did not start this January or this year. We can see different things that happened at least 3 years ago, 2 years ago, and they might help to understand what's going on now. What you can see here are different events. This happened 2 years ago. This is something called the video escándalos that you might know what happened there. It was a period where we saw in some news a businessman giving money to a political operator of López Obrador. And basically, López Obrador has been ahead on polls for more than 3 years, and this might be the first event where he had a crisis, crisis of his image. In a way, he had before an advantage of 8 to 10 points. All depends of the pollster you might check. But during this crisis, the scandalous, it was clear that he had some, he was vulnerable, and the election could be quite close, quite tight. After that, you have something that we know as the impeachment process, when he became very, very, very popular. In general, what happened here, that might be one of the, I know, most important events in terms of public opinion, because he got the support of most of the population. In the Mexican public, in their minds, what they saw is a very unfair process compared to what was happening in Mexico. You had some scandals at the same time, like Pemex Gate or Amigos de Fox, where those scandals were related with corruption. And what happened here is that what the voters saw is the guy who was in front of every poll, and the government wanted to put put him out of the race because he did not respect the law. And comparing corruption with not respect for the law is like unbalanced. You know, in a country where maybe the law is not that important for the public. After that, we have this, which is when this is August 2005, when until this point he was the mayor of Mexico City, and after that he was out for 6 months of every. He was not in the news anymore. He didn't have his daily conference. Once again, you can see this trend. He went down in the polls. And this was November, December. The difference was, once again, 5 points, 4 points, three points ahead. And after that, we have the beginning of the campaign. The last part of this trend might be known or might be classified as the period of negative campaigns. A way to explain what's happening now in the election, I'm going to come back to this one, is that if you see what happened to his public image. This is the number, well, the percentage of people who knew the names of the candidates. This is 3 years ago. Madrazo and López Obrador were very well known since the beginning of this race. This is Calderon. This is a year ago, less than one third of the population knew him. So in a way, he's the most recent well-known candidate. And this is these are the other two candidates, Patricia Mercado and Roberto Campa. So by now, this is pretty normal. I mean, most of the voters know them. But what is a big change in this election is this chart. This is once again López Obrador. This is an index of opinion, good opinions versus bad opinions for the candidates. And López Obrador, for a while, he has been the point of reference in terms of good opinion. During certain points of this race or election, he was ahead in this index, and he had a positive opinion of 50, more or less. But when you see what happened in the last 2 months, is basically with the negative campaigns, is this, that it's in a way this was a point of resistance for a while, and he went down to 8 points, and now is pretty much even. He doesn't have a good image or a bad image. He's in zero practically. And what is very interesting about this is that you have this trend here with the video scandals, and you have this trend here when he was out of the news. And but we never had before these two effects together. A negative campaign and him being out of the news or without the possibility of respond the messages of what Calderón's campaign was saying. So for us, the explanation of for this election is that first looks like the PRD forgot that after all López Obrador being ahead for more than 3 years doesn't mean that he was not vulnerable to the messages that a negative campaign can create. During these two months, practically the PRD did not answer any of the accusations that the PAN made, like being dangerous or that he was dangerous because he put the he was not responsible with the economy, or the city was in debt. All the messages that the PAN the messages that the PAN used to attack him they didn't respond until very, very recently. So part of what is new in this election, and I'm going to come back to this, is that it looks like it doesn't matter what poll, López Obrador has shown a sort of point of resistance around 33, 34 points, even in the worst moments, and even now. And what is new in this is this trend. A reason to think that this might be still we have a month ahead and things can happen, is that you have a lot of variance in this trend, and you have that this trend is a little bit more stable. For this matter, in this analysis, the PRI is not a player. They come in third place with a difference of 6 to 8 points. And the reason why Calderón might be vulnerable, firstly, is because he's not very well known, as this trend shows. I mean, his good image is very recent. Most of the public doesn't know him very well. And besides that, if you see this trend, the reason why his candidacy is growing might not be because of him, because while he's growing, his image is flat. So there is something else happening there. And basically we have two explanations of things that can change. One is the federal campaign, the Fox campaign in favor of the PAN, which stopped just this last Monday, or well, formally it had to stop 2 days ago. The quarantena, this period that every government has to stop, not just the federal government, local governments as well, might signify a change in this trend. So the what might be a reason for concern to the Calderón's team is the fact that his good image is not well established and it's not very strong, and he might be not responsible for the growing of for his growing in this race. Besides that, we have some. This might be the most divided election in regional terms and in terms of split ticket. This is a map of the five federal districts, circunscripciones. As you might know, the Congress in Mexico is a mixed Congress, so we have a congressman that comes from a district and congressmen which are party deputies. So in this map, what you can see is that circunscription 1 and 2, obviously Calderón has his main advantage. His image is positive. He has the same image pretty much in all the three different regions, and that's not the case of López Obrador. While nationally in this poll, López Obrador might be on 8 points of positive image. In the north of Mexico, he's less than 23, so which is a big difference. Of course, in this region, which is circumscriptions 4 and 5, he has a pretty good image. Calderón still is on 20, which is, as I said, is very even. It doesn't matter of the region. And this last region, which is circumscription 3, which is actually, in terms of voters, is half of this and this. And the weight of this region, 4 and 5, is the same of all this blue area. So in a way, that says a lot about the concentration of the population. So the problems for the PRD are in this region, definitely, where actually the PRD does not govern just by exception, which is the case of Baja Sur and Zacatecas, and the image of López Obrador or the PRD is basically done by mass media, and is where in this region is where he has been more vulnerable, and this is going to be a very divided election as well, because the way people is voting for Congress are voting is very different the way they are voting for the president. For example, in the case of the PRI, all depends on the poll, but basically Madrazo is behind between 6 and 8 points of his party, which is a major failure, or it's a major vulnerability for his candidacy, and that's a reason why we as pollsters are divided among. So some of us think that the PRI cannot go that low, that cannot go under 25 points, just because of his party, and you can see some other polls like Reforma or El Universal where. Madrazo is in a place around 22 points. Finally, as part of our explanation, what we try to measure is the effect of campaigns, and we try to evaluate at least some of the messages that have been in the political spots. And the reason why we think why we can observe these trends. First, we evaluate this negative spot, which is maybe you have heard of it. It's when López Obrador called the president with the name of this strange bird, Chachalaca, and then the Acción Nacional made a spot of that that event. 4 out of 5 voters know about this. 30%. Well, they think that the message comes from the party and not from Felipe Calderón, which is a basic rule. It's a 101 for strategy. The negative campaigns go through a third person and not directly from the candidate. In that, they have done well. And the change of image in terms of negativity, this is self-report from the voter, says that 31% of these 82 has changed in a negative way his image of López Obrador based in this event, based in this spot. The other one, which is López Obrador is dangerous for Mexico, is very well known as well, but it's possible that it doesn't have the same effect. So in terms of efficacy, this has proved to be more efficient or better than the other negative campaign. What is very interesting in this evaluation of the spots as well is that Madrazo has had a negative campaign against López Obrador as well, but he shows himself very negative. This is a spot where Madrazo asked López Obrador to go to the debate directly, and what you can see here is that obviously most of the people identify this spot with Roberto Madrazo. There is a change of image of López Obrador in a negative way, but what is in a way funny is that people change the image of Roberto Madrazo as well in a negative way, so that can explain a lot of what's going on there. And so finally, just some numbers about the effect of the debate. We don't know exactly what's going to be the effect of the next debate. What we know is that, as most of the literature or the books suggest, the evidence, in general, in debates, you don't have a change in political preference. Based in the last debate, we have that only 4% of the voters said that they changed their preference. And this is a series of questions where they were vote for this candidate and they changed in favor of this one. So a way to argue that Calderón won the debate might be that 25% of these 4% said that they, based in the debate, they changed in favor of Calderón. What we can see in the next 40 days, in the from today to the 2nd of July, are three things that might change these trends. First is the fact that the all the governments, but especially the federal governments, are not doing campaigns for their parties. Secondly is the debate. Even when the effect is marginal, 1 point or 2 points might be a significant difference as an event. And finally, if there is going to be an effective answer from the PRD to what has been 2 months of negative campaigns of coming from Acción Nacional. Thank you.
Marco, thank you very much. Ulysses?
Just 1 second and I'll be ready.
Yeah.
And I think you will hear the same things more than once. So I'll try to just refer to them rapidly so we don't become boring. So because we do the same thing with the same numbers and with the same polls. Well, not the same polls, but very similar polls. Okay, so I'm Ulises Beltrán from BGC. Thank you very much for this invitation. I'm very excited of being here. And this is the poll of polls. And the only thing I'd like to show, I mean, this is beginning in February. And this is the moment of change, the end of, at the middle of March, in which from being absolutely, for many time in Mexico, people thought that López Obrador would be president and this is it. But at the middle of March, some polls start being published. And then it became very clear that the election was at least very, very well, it was a very close contest, and that things can, that he didn't have it as everybody thought that before, no? Sorry. Now, this is the three polls we have done. This is a national polls, and this is what you can see. It from a lead of 7 points, it's it changed to a lead of Calderón of 5 points. Now, the truth is that there are two type of polls now. Some of them say that the tide is a tie between Calderón and López Obrador. And some of us, me among them, and them, by the way, think that the Calderón is ahead beyond margin of error, whatever that means. As I said, the main change took place in March, and after that moment, we see some kind of a stabilization in the trends. And we think that López Obrador is, as Francisco just said, we cannot find some debate effect. We think that it was the trend that Calderón gained at the middle of March that just continued, and that this positive impulse just, the debate only helped this positive trend in his preferences, but not a major change in preferences by the debate. Now, what I'm going to try to do now is to show you where do I think the main changes happen, why did it happen, and try to give some explanation of this major change. The first thing I see is that Calderón has very concentrated preferences among different social strata, and now he has a widespread support, and he gained what you need to gain in a campaign. That is to say, you cannot win an election if you are supported only of a specific strata, even if this strata is very big. So if you see in February, if you see any of these by income, this is the preferences by each of these strata, and you can see from being concentrated in the highest level of income, now it is well distributed except for the lowest one. And on the contrary, PRI and López Obrador lost. If you see by schooling, the same happens. From being badly distributed in February, now it is well distributed among all the strata. And if you see age, it also happened, except for López Obrador paradise. That is to say, the people, how do they call it? The edad avanzada. I can't remember. I know the elderly. How do they call them? Whatever. No, you know that he gave money in the federal district to people beyond 70 years. And when I saw my father-in-law, who was very much a conservative, when he started thinking of supporting López Obrador, and I said, this thing really worked, and it has worked. So as you can see, that's the only detail. So and. The next thing I want to show you is how the support of Calderón grew in different regions. And what we did, instead of grouping the regions by geography, we thought that it could be more interesting to group them according to who's the governor in the area. And so we have three regions in which PAN, PRI, or PRD is the governor. And what we try to find out is the size of the market for PAN. We thought that the good ceiling for that market was what Fox obtained in those regions in 2000. I mean, you can say maybe it would be very difficult for Calderón to go beyond what the folks gained in obtained in 2000. So in the next graph, you're going to see the differences between what folks gained in 2000, what Cárdenas won in 2000, and what La Bastida won in 2000, in the year 2000 in this different region. I think this is a little difficult to see, but it's very interesting because the yellow bars, it's those states where the PRD governs. And as you can see, López Obrador, from having a 5 points different, the preferences for López Obrador was 5 points above what Cárdenas won in 2000, and that was in February, and now there's no difference. He gets what Cárdenas gained, he obtained in 2000. And in the Priista region, he loses 2 points. And in the Panista region, which are the blue bars, it remains the same. He has a 3-point advantage over what Cárdenas got in 2000. The Madrazo is the most interesting thing, and this is where the main changes you can find. If you see the Madrazo widens the difference in the Priista area. My point is very simple. The battleground for these elections are the region in which the PRI governs today. And as you see, Madrazo is widening his preferences according to what I would describe as the limit of the market he can gain, which is La Bastida in 2000. And what is the big advance of Calderón campaign? He wins in the Perredista area 1 point, but he reduces to half the difference of what Fox got and what he gets in the second poll, from 6 points difference to 3 point differences. And in the Panista area, he has a 1 point difference, which is not much, and he has not advanced. What you can see, of course, is that this is very bad news for López Obrador, because wherever he is, his party is government, he loses a lot. And these are good news for Calderón, in which in the Priista area gains 3 points, advances half the size of the market that you could get is gained by him. No? So, that is what he gains now. In this poll, between the poll in February, in April, and the one in May, by the way, the data, unfortunately, we all are now in the field work at this point. Most of us are in the field work at this point. So the things you are looking at is a poll, at least this one, taken at the end of April and the first days of May. So it's a little old. It's very unfortunate this is the date, because in a week you will have the wave of polls published in Mexico. No? What happened is that even there is a change in preferences. I think the main and Francisco noticed that and mentioned that. The main change was in the perception of the image on the opinion about the three candidates. That is the major change that you can observe between the early polls and these ones in May. This, that seems a little complicated. It is not that complicated. In the horizontal axis, you have the general opinion of candidates, and in the vertical axis, you have the level of name recognition of the different candidates. So to make this graph simple, I would say that Mother Teresa would be here. Everybody knows her and everybody loves her, and pick anyone you want. This is hell. Everybody knows you, and everybody hates you. No, so this is hell, and this is paradise. No, the interesting thing in the campaigns is that the level of knowledge you get increases naturally. I mean, just because you are in the press, because you make ads, because so. And the idea is that you move from low levels of knowledge and bad opinions, and you try to move in a diagonal way to paradise and join Mother Teresa in paradise, no? And what happened is very interesting in the last polls. You can see how, to begin with, Roberto Madrazo, I regret to say that, but I don't know if he's in hell, but he's not in the right place. And he moved a little bit here from a bad opinion to a little better opinion, but he didn't get out of hell. But the biggest change, as you can see, is Calderón's campaign was very ineffective at the beginning. This is November, this is February, this is March, so his level of knowledge was increasing, but he couldn't move to the right. And I should be careful about this because he's already in the right, but he couldn't move to the right in terms of opinion. But at the end, between March and May, he got a big leap to a better opinion. By the way, this line is a general average we have produced of many, many political leaders in Mexico. No? So, and on the contrary, as you can see in the case of López Obrador, from being here in February, close to Mother Teresa, he's now all the way here in terms of opinion. And in the last month, from March to May, this small change in the general overall perception of the candidate. So this is the campaign effect between March and May, which is very substantive. It is very important. And we will try to find out where does it come from. Those are good news for PAN, but these are not so good news for PAN. This is the preferences of what we call the independents. In every campaign, there are many actors. The main actors are the candidates, but if you look at the press, you will find another actor who's ever present. They call somebody undecided. Somebody else calls them switchers, independents, whatever. No. So if you have a candidate who's losing, you look at the independents and undecided, whatever, and say, you can win this election because there are this many in the undecided. And if you are winning, you say, well, the undecideds are not that undecided, so don't worry. No, my point is very simple. Even though these are the preferences of the what we call independents, which in our poll is 37% of the likely voters, and if you see their preferences, their leaning, who do they lean, who they would be probably vote for, and you can see that AMLO remains very strong here. He has 39%, and Calderón has 33% of the of preferences among these people. I should say that Reforma published a similar thing yesterday, right? And the preferences of the leaning of the independents was 40-40. If we have 5 points difference here in this poll and people, these independents voted like this, according to this distribution, the election, my poll would leave it tied or with a little lead for López Obrador. Probably. I never did that mathematics, but it's, I mean, he still has an opportunity. He has a way to move because these independents are very important in deciding the election. So AMLO is very strong among the independents. There are doubts if this has changed in the last month. Reforma says it has changed and now it's tied. But whoever gets a lead among these potential voters might win the election because the election is very close. Now, I wouldn't lose much time. This is very much what Francisco did with much more detail. I just wanted to show you that probably the important thing to show is, well, Calderón got numbers are the what we call a spontaneous recollection of the ad. Have you seen this ad? Who's and what does it say? And spontaneously, not prompting the ad to the respondent, because then you don't know what you get. No, these numbers never get above these levels, by the way. No, and what I wanted to show here is that Calderón was very able to position himself in the two issues that his campaign was trying to sell. Before clean hands, that loses 8 points, obviously, because it is not any longer on the air, and the other one, the president of the employment, as his motto says, no? Calderón, el presidente del empleo, no? So he was very able to. But the thing that is very remarkable is that López Obrador, highest recall comes from an ad that it is not his ad, that is the attack ad on Shut Up Chachalacas. No? So that's very bad news for them, although we have to mention that his positioning as the candidate closer to the people and closer to the poor people is very strong. His, those attributes remain in the hands of López Obrador. No? And Madrazo, well, I should say that he is remembered because he attacked AMLO. And the, he did, he has been doing a very strong ads, positive, let's say, white ads about crime, and he has a 6-point recognition compared to 11 and 10 points of the others. No? So that's I love this this one. I took the idea from Roy Campos, who said exactly this. It is impossible to know in May what's going to happen in July, mostly in this contest. No? So we are not forecasting, and what I would like to do now to you, I'll try to talk to you about, is where things can go and why. The first thing is we think that preferences are not crystallized. This is a term that is more or less common among people who studies campaigns and these things. Here, this is a very simple graph. I promise it's simple, Paul. This is where La Bastida was ahead. This is zero, the difference between front runner and second place. So this is front runner is ahead, and this is front runner is behind. And the black graph is 2000, the difference between La Bastida and Fox. And the red one is the front runner, who is AMLO minus Calderón. What really has struck me a lot is the similarity of these curves. And as you can see, April and May are where the things change. The first thing that strikes me is that before March, Mexicans do not pay much attention to campaigns, and believing whatever your pollster tells you of the preferences you have, you better take a square root of that number and plan differently, a lesson that López Obrador didn't learn. So he thought he was 10 points ahead, and I think those were not measuring anything about the real preferences in thing. So we are in the middle of a period of in which preferences are going to change a lot. That means I wouldn't be surprised in the next, if in the next wave of polls, López Obrador is ahead and Calderón behind, and whatever happens, I wouldn't be surprised at all. Things are going to move according to this. I should mention that it is only T minus one, so it is not a very solid inference that I'm doing, but at least I can show this. And then you can see in June, things are going to get even, but that is considering that the campaigns do not make an impact. Now, three reasons, or more reasons, I have three here, no, why the things can change. Everybody asks always if the polls have an impact among voters. Yes, they do, not because the voters read polls. I mean, in Mexico, I can assure you that not many people know even of the existence of polls, but the campaign teams do. And the campaign teams decide and change strategies according to what polls say. And the biggest change that you can see, it is amazing, the change in the strategy of the PRD campaign is 180% degrees. I mean, from making, they have invested in 50 million pesos, and I'm off, 50 million pesos, and now they bought 360 million pesos in paid airtime. So from thinking that they could win the election just by being in the press, they changed. Secondly, they became strongly negative against Calderón. Probably at this point, the level of audience reached by negative ads from Calderón against AMLO and negative ads from AMLO against Calderón are even or close to be even. Thirdly, the second debate. I think we don't know what's going to happen. Nobody knows what happens in debates. The world is divided between those who say that debates are definitive and then change the trends, and those who say that debates do not matter at all. I'm on the second side, by the way. Other three things that have to be taken into account is that local campaigns matter, and matter a lot, and they do have an influence in the federal vote. The divided vote can be, it exists, that is to say somebody votes president in a way and then congressman or local, whatever, in a different way, but not in a very huge figures. The third thing I should mention is the end of the campaign, of the government campaigns. Mexico is a place where paid, non-paid, because it is free, most of it, but the use of public television for political advertisement, the first buyer of airtime in Mexico is the presidency of the republic and the government, and it's ahead of General Motors, whatever is the largest thing, and it is over as of yesterday, no? The campaigns of government are off, so I don't know what effect can it have in the preferences, but that's a different context in which the campaign is now. That. And the third one is obviously conflicts. I don't know if you heard about the Atenco thing, the people beaten up by the police and all these things that are happening, and the miners thing, which is a very delicate issue in which the government tried to solve a problem with the miners union, and not surprisingly, they haven't done very properly, I think. So this is a telephone tracking, and this is the last graph, I promise. This is a telephone tracking. Telephone trackings do not show you the real preferences because it is biased, but it helps us to get to see trends and to see if things are changing or not. And this is very interesting in the sense that this is what we would think it's the bounce of the debate. The problem for Calderón is that leaving the bounce of the debate didn't stop rapidly, so they almost tied the election here. Both things are back to where they were before. So the only thing I want to show this is that things changed. They are changing, but not in a way that you could expect very different results in the next polls. And thank you very much, and it's all yours.
Ulises, thank you very much for an interesting presentation. By the way, all the various presentations will be on the CSIS website this afternoon.
First, I'd like to thank CSIS for the invitation. It's a very exciting place to be, and I'm glad that he got together several of the people that have been working on the polling industry in Mexico for many years. I'm going to try to answer a question that has been posed to us in many forums, either by the investment bankers, by foreign journalists, by foreign analysts, but also by the Mexican business community. Will Mexico become stable? Has Mexico been socially polarized during this electoral race? I mean, López Obrador has try to portray himself as the candidate of the poor, especially when you compare, and the foreign community does it a lot, when you compare López Obrador with what may have happened in Venezuela or Bolivia or even Peru. So has Mexican society become more polarized because of the electoral campaign, because of López Obrador? And also, what are the chances that there will be post-electoral conflict or mobilization if López Obrador loses? So these are the two main questions that I will try to address in this presentation. Obviously, we can talk about electoral trends later on, but these are the two questions, and I'm going to use polling data that we have been gathered since 2004 because the issue of social polarization is something that we have been measuring since 2004. So we can see how social polarization has changed in Mexico for the past 2 years. In order to do that, I use a methodology that was developed here in the U.S., especially to measure polarization between African Americans and whites. So the key thing here is how, or at least in the American context, is how African Americans perceive whites and vice versa. And the farther apart they are from each other gives you the degree of polarization that there is between those two groups. So I applied the same methodology to the case of Mexico, but applied to self-perception of social class, to self-perception of political identities, and also religious identities. And this is a perception that all the Mexican public has about several different social groups. And as you can see, the group that is the best regarded in Mexico are the Catholic community. Catholics are the group that are perceived as the group that has the most positive traits. Later on, we have the lower class, clase baja. Middle class, it's also close. But what I want to stress to you is the perception about political groups. Panistas, perredistas, priistas are the groups that are the less well-regarded in Mexican society. But what about the gap between different social groups? How do they perceive the in-group and the out-group? And you can see, and this is something that I want to reinforce to you, is that the polarization between perredistas and priistas and perredistas and panistas is the highest among all social groups. That is, perredistas are the ones who see farther apart the other political groups. It doesn't happen with priistas, for instance. Priistas do not tend to see the other groups in such a polarized way. But take a look also at how lower class see the upper class. The distance is only 1.1. The message is, what we are witnessing here is that the main polarization that is taking place, it's a political polarization. It's a partisan polarization. It's not social polarization. And this makes a lot of sense. I mean, we are in the middle of an electoral campaign, and this is also good news because the political cleavages have not translated into social cleavages. How does this fare in comparison to 2004? Has polarization increased or decreased for several groups? And this is the comparison, but just let me tell you that the groups that have increased their polarization are mainly the political groups. Among the social groups, there is not that much difference between 2004 and 2006. So the message, to repeat it, it's clear. Political polarization is the largest polarization that we have in Mexico, and it has also increased in the past 2 years. Social polarization has not increased, and it's more relatively low. This is good news. We saw it with Ulises Beltran data when he was looking at the support for the different candidates by several demographic groups. What we see is that all three candidates have a more or less strong presence among different socioeconomic groups, and this is news. Indeed, and probably we'll see it in, we saw it in Francisco's presentation, the main polarization that we are having in Mexico, that we are witnessing in Mexico, besides the political, and obviously the political one, it's a regional polarization. We have the central part of the country strongly in support of López Obrador, and the northern part of the country shows a very low degree of support for López Obrador. So this is in terms of political and social polarization. So the answer is no. What is the likelihood of post-electoral mobilization in the 2006 presidential election? This question is becoming recurrent because the contest is really, really close. So, and López Obrador is being perceived as somebody that it's prone to take to the streets if he doesn't like electoral outcomes. There is a lot of talk about his experiences as a candidate for the PRD in the state of Tabasco. So what are the chances that this occur? And the first thing that I want to show you is some data that we have been asked through the whole electoral campaign. If the winner of the presidential race is not your preferred candidate, would you accept the results without any doubt? And we have 49% of the Mexican population that says that they would have no doubts about the results, even if their candidate would lose. But there is an important percentage, 34%, that says that they would have doubts. And a 7% percentage that says that they would reject the election results. This is, to some extent, something that happens in some developed countries. international, the comparative study of electoral system shows you data where people do not tend to believe the results when they are against their electoral preferences. So what we are having here is probably that people wouldn't believe that much results that show that their candidate lost. But what is important here is to show the difference in skepticism about the electoral outcome depending on which candidate people support. And as you can see, supporters of Felipe Calderón have a 52% probability of accepting the outcome if Calderón loses, 53% for Madrazo, but the support of López Obradoristas, of Perredistas, is lower. It's the lower of all these three groups, only 44%. And 13% would reject the election results, which is almost three times the probability of Calderonistas and two times the probability of Madrazistas. So we are witnessing in the electoral base of López Obrador a more skeptical approach about accepting the outcome if López Obrador doesn't win. We also ask in this survey, if the candidate you voted for disputes the electoral results, would you be willing to carry out the following activities to support your candidate? Signing letter, 46% say that they could sign letters in favor of their losing candidate. 33% say they could attend a demonstration. 19% say they could participate in sit-downs. 18% in strikes. And 13% say they could take public offices. At least this shows you the willingness of people to participate in some activities to protest an electoral outcome they do not like. When we disaggregate these results by which candidate people support, we see the same trend that I mentioned before. Supporters of López Obrador are more willing to attend a demonstration, 45%, than supporters of Calderón, 28%, and Madrazistas, 23%, although we'll see if this decline is just an outlier of it will go up, especially because probably you've heard about it, there is a lot of controversy right now going on in Mexico because what it's called elección de Estado. This is the support that the PAN candidate is getting from the government is as such that it resembles the support that the PRI got in the past from the government. So if this continues and it's still going on, this will surely be reflected in the results of our service that it's right now in the field. The same thing happens with signing letters. Supporters of López Obrador have a higher probability of doing something in order to protest the outcome. Taking offices, 20% supporters of López Obrador, 12% of Calderonistas, and only 4% of Madrazistas. The same thing for sit-downs, 27, 19, 13. Participating in a strike, this is the only thing that there is some similarity between Calderonistas and López Obradoristas. But the general picture is very clear. Supporters of López Obrador are more willing to take actions to protest the electoral outcome in case López Obrador doesn't win. So this being said, and as we know in political science, mobilizing people is not an easy thing. It depends on a lot of factors which are conditional to each other. So this gives you at least a portrayal of why, of the factors that I think that it will influence if we have a post-electoral mobilization in Mexico. The first thing, and it's an obvious one, is who wins and who loses. Some candidates are more prone to protest electoral outcomes that they don't like. Some others are more institutional. The second factor is that the probability that the election is close. The chances that there will be mobilization will be higher if the election is really close than if it is not. A candidate that loses for like 25 percentage points will have a lot of difficulty to carry out protest activities. Third, related to this, is that the probability that the loser calls for mobilization. This is a very critical factor, is what it's called political entrepreneurship. Who is going to do the mobilizing? Who is going to call people to go to the streets? And here the critical question is if the loser candidate accepts or rejects the outcome. The second, the runner-up. And four is the probability that his or her supporters take the streets. So with these factors in mind, what are the probabilities of post-electoral mobilization if López Obrador loses? The logic of this is more or less the same. If Felipe Calderón wins, will he win in a close or a non-close election? And if he wins in a close election, will AMLO call for mobilization or will he not? Will he accept the outcome? And if he calls for mobilization, will people take the streets or will they not? Will they not take the streets? We have some data about the probabilities that Calderón wins, and based on the survey results that I just showed you, that the rank and file attends. What we don't know is how close the election will be and if the probability that AMLO will call an election. So these are the two variables on the moment of the model. The probability that Calderón wins, I took it not from surveys, not to be biased. I took it from this internet betting site in trade, which shows you the probabilities. And these guys follow very closely the polls. So the probability as of 2 days ago of Felipe Calderón winning in trade was 52%. And as we saw, the probability that supporters of López Obrador would attend demonstration is 45%. So these are more or less the same thing with Calderón. The probability that AMLO wins is 41% and 28%. So what are the probabilities? If Felipe Calderón wins, the probability that there will be post-electoral mobilization by López Obrador is almost of 18% if it is a close election. I mean, if the probability of a close election is 0.8, and if we are more or less certain that he will call for an election. But let's say that we don't know what is the probability that López Obrador will mobilize people, will protest the outcome. Let's say, let's flip a coin. So he has a 50-50 chance of accepting or rejecting the outcome, no matter how close the election is. So if it is a close election, the probability that López Obrador will mobilize people, will reject the outcome and will try to mobilize people is about 9%. Look at Calderón. Calderón, if López Obrador wins, the probability that Calderón will mobilize or the probability that there will be a post-electoral conflict is lower, just because of the fact that the electoral constituency of Calderón is not as prone to go to the streets as López Obrador's. Even if Calderón and López Obrador are more or less the same in terms of rejecting or accepting the outcome, just because they have a different social base, the chances that a post-electoral mobilization will occur are lower. So what I want to convey to you here is that the chances that there will be post-electoral conflict depend on several conditional factors. So to the summary of all I've been saying. First, class polarization has not increased because of López Obrador's campaigning style. As expected, it is partisan polarization which has risen. Political and not social polarization prevails in Mexico at this moment. Third, the probability of political mobilization if López Obrador loses is about 9% if we don't know how he'll behave. I mean, if we are certain that he will protest the outcome in case he loses in a close election, the probability jumps to about 18%. Calderón has a lower probability of taking the streets just because of his electoral base. And I think that will be. Thank you.
Jorge, thank you very much for an interesting presentation, and I'm sure that the audience appreciates you not putting up the same slides that back when Ulysses had, and giving it a slightly different perspective. And now Roy will follow as soon as he finds his presentation.
Gracias. Voy a hablar en español. Primero les pido una disculpa. Y después les doy las gracias por la invitación.
And Roy, let me just interrupt quickly. For those of you that do not speak Spanish, we do have translation equipment, and I was told to say that channel 1 is for English and channel 3 is for Spanish if you haven't figured it out.
Roy. Aunque por lo que veo la mayoría habla español porque nadie ha puesto el traductor, pero bien, les agradezco la invitación. El problema de que estemos 5 encuestadores que nos conozcamos también es que de repente vamos a repetir muchas de las cosas. Entonces, bueno, de todos modos, cada quien con su visión un poco distinto. Lo primero que quisiera hacer ver es que el presidente Fox es un presidente bien evaluado. O sea, sobre todo en esas épocas en donde aquí en Estados Unidos están viendo un presidente que está abajo de los 40% ya desde hace rato, que está prácticamente cerca de los 30%. El presidente Fox tiene una aprobación de arriba del 60% desde hace un buen número de meses. Incluso su evaluación este año ha sido superior a la de su primer año de gestión. Entonces, tenemos un presidente bien evaluado, a diferencia de otros países. Y entonces, bueno, es un jugador, sí es un jugador. Es un jugador porque de alguna manera se está calificando su presidencia. Entonces, un jugador, no nomás es un jugador importante, es bien evaluado como presidente. Y sus programas sociales, el 26%, uno de cada 4 mexicanos, recibe apoyo, tiene él o algún familiar, recibe apoyo del principal programa social que tiene, que es Oportunidades. Entonces, sí es un presidente bien evaluado, que además con programas sociales, 13% se siente beneficiario del Seguro Popular y el 4% ha recibido crédito para construir o para remodelar su vivienda. Son programas sociales exitosos del presidente Fox. Entonces, cuando está en campaña un presidente que su un candidato que su principal oferta son programas sociales, el presidente actual tiene una gran cantidad de programas sociales, ¿no? Utilizando algunas palabras que alguna vez Francisco Bonilla utilizó, el presidente Fox se metió por la puerta de atrás, ¿no? O sea, está atacando de alguna manera los programas de izquierda utilizando precisamente sus programas. Bien, lo segundo es que cuando analizamos, eso es el presidente, cuando analizamos los partidos, porque ahorita todo el mundo ha hablado de López Obrador y de Calderón, y como que al PRI no lo han mencionado en forma importante, como si no existiera ya madrazo. Cuando vemos los partidos, primero déjenme mostrarle una gráfica que he mostrado otras veces, que es el PRI en los estados. Estos son los 32 estados, y es el porcentaje de votación que ha obtenido el PRI en cada una de las 32 elecciones de gobernador. El promedio de votos que ha obtenido es el 42%. Solo 5 estados saca menos del 36% de los votos. Es un partido poderosísimo, que no hay municipio del país en donde no tenga estructura, no hay sección en donde no tenga representante. Es un partido muy importante, o sea, sigue siendo el partido que más votos genera en las elecciones locales. ¿Qué necesitaba? Viendo esta gráfica, ¿qué necesitaba el PRI? Necesitaba un candidato que no le quitara mucho. Es lo que necesitaba el PRI. O sea, el PRI tenía ya la estructura y necesitaba un candidato que llegara legítimamente y que no le quitara mucho. El PAN, cuando esta misma gráfica la veo en el PAN tiene el 35% del total de los votos para gobernador. Tiene problemas regionales en algunos estados. Guerrero con el 1%, Tabasco con el 2%, Nayarit que gobernaba con el 6%. O sea, está muy ubicado, pero es un partido nacional que tiene en general más de 36% en todos sus estados, aún perdiendo, como el caso de Colima, Sinaloa, Sonora, en donde aún perdiendo saca porcentajes importantísimos. Entonces, lo que necesitaba el PAN era un candidato que agregara algo más allá del panismo. Era todo lo que necesitaba el PAN. Y el PRD, a diferencia de los otros partidos, es un partido débil porque no está ni bien distribuido en el país, ni con suficiente fuerza. Saca el 19% de los votos y tiene problemas prácticamente en la mayoría de los estados. Solo en 7 estados está arriba del 36, los 5 que gobierna y Nayarit y Tabasco. Lo cual significa que el PRD necesitaba un candidato que sobrepasara al partido, que volviera una elección de candidatos y no de partidos, que se perdiera la atención de los partidos y fueran las popularidades y las presencias de los candidatos la que imperara. Bien, cuando lo vemos en distribución de gobiernos, vemos que efectivamente el PRI es primera fuerza, gobierna 17 estados, el PAN es segunda fuerza, gobierna 9, el PRD gobierna 5, Chiapas, no sé quién lo gobierna, total son 32, no sé qué partido lo gobierna, lo que quise decir. Entonces, bueno, por cierto, es la misma distribución geográfica que hace 4 años. Y si le comparamos con 99, que es como llegaron a la elección del 2000, las diferencias son realmente pocas. El PRI bajó de 21 a 17, el PAN de 7 a 9, el PRD de 4 a 5. Son realmente no muy importantes en 6 años de que el PRI ya no está en el poder. Si el país fuera normal y los candidatos fueran normales, no habría duda de que hay una primera, una segunda y una tercera fuerza electoral. Pero resulta que empieza la contienda donde el candidato más impopular está en el partido más fuerte y el candidato más popular en el partido más débil, y entonces la contienda se vuelve interesante. Bien, entonces, esta teoría de la identidad partidista, nada más ver la última parte de la gráfica, lo que está creciendo es la identidad de el ninguno, los no partidistas, los independientes. Eso es lo que causó los pleitos en los partidos, las carreras por las contiendas, o sea, el priismo se empezó a deshacer cuando, por la forma en que llegó Madrazo a la candidatura, por los pleitos que generó, porque pelearse con el Bester, por pelearse con Montiel, por pelearse con mucha gente, el priismo empezó a deshacerse y empezó a disminuir el sentimiento partidista, y los que crecen son los independientes. De octubre del año pasado a la fecha, han pasado de 28 a 44% el porcentaje de gente que se declara independiente. Bueno, los candidatos, ahora ya los candidatos. Esta es otra forma de presentar lo que mencionaban ya antes mis colegas. La opinión positiva y negativa que ha tenido la gente, cómo ha crecido, referido no solo a los que lo conocen, sino al total de la población. O sea, toda gente nueva que lo va conociendo se agrega a ser positivo o ser negativo. Vean cómo de agosto del año pasado a la fecha, cuando ya Calderón gana la interna del PAN y hace campaña, cómo es explosivo el porcentaje de gente que tiene buena opinión de él. También ha crecido el porcentaje que tiene mala opinión de él porque se ha dado a conocer o lo han dado a conocer, pero ha crecido el saldo de opiniones positivas. Y vean al revés, bueno, Madrazo, sus opiniones positivas se mantienen igualitas, o sea, esas no cambian, los priistas duros, los madracistas duros, esos no hay forma de sacarlos de ahí, pero los negativos sí le van aumentando. En general, los negativos no iban a votar por él. Entonces, bueno, tampoco le preocupa mucho, pero los positivos no los ha podido hacer crecer, por eso es que su preferencia no la puede hacer crecer. Solo el 18% de los ciudadanos del país tiene alguna opinión positiva de Madrazo. Pero en cambio, vean el efecto de López Obrador, la gráfica esta de abajo son las opiniones negativas. Los últimos 2 meses, febrero y marzo, el crecimiento explosivo de las opiniones negativas sobre López Obrador. ¿No? Esto es, pues bueno, son campañas negativas. Entonces, la campaña negativa lo que logró es generar opiniones negativas sobre López Obrador, que no había tenido realmente unos ataques como los que tuvo, y en ese momento el crecimiento. En cambio, él no logró hacer una campaña que subiera sus opiniones positivas. Entonces, ahí se quedó, y ese ha sido uno de los cambios que ha habido por lo que sea. Bueno, Patricia Mercado, ¿cómo aprovechó el debate? O sea, ¿cómo? En general, ser candidato de partido pequeño es negativo, ya porque la imagen de los partidos pequeños es que son negocios y no son partidos realmente. Bueno, Patricia Mercado aprovechó el debate e inmediatamente sube su porcentaje de menciones positivas, siempre referidas al total de la población. En cambio, Roberto Campa, el otro candidato de partidos, ¿cómo se quedó? Arriba las opiniones negativas. O sea, no logró generar nada de opiniones positivas. Roberto Campa desaprovechó totalmente el debate. Bueno, otra forma de ver, ahora sí la carrera. Bueno, esta es mi gráfica de cómo ha ido evolucionando. Yo había traído adelante a López Obrador permanentemente y en la última encuesta, que es a finales de abril, después del debate, por primera vez Calderón se pone arriba de López Obrador. De hecho, Calderón a finales del año pasado lo traía en tercer lugar. Entonces, primero pasó claramente a Madrazo, se mantuvo durante todos los meses previos arriba de Madrazo, y en la última encuesta, que es la de abril, incluso ya pasa, aunque ligeramente, a López Obrador. Para ser congruente con muchas veces que lo digo, les muestro todas, que es algo de que las encuestas todas, estas son las 8 encuestas confiables públicas, porque Rafa ha dejado de publicar, entonces no está aquí, entonces no está en esta lista, pero son las 8 encuestas que podemos ubicar públicas. En todas las 8, el ganador es Felipe Calderón, con distintas ventajas. Si simplemente las promedio, como un ejercicio que no tiene mucho sentido porque son distintas fechas, distintos tamaños de muestra, distintas metodologías y distintas todas, la ventaja de entre abril y lo que va de mayo es de 3 puntos de Felipe Calderón, es el promedio de estas. Aparece la que se publicó ayer de Reforma, de 39-35. Y sí, efectivamente, como algunos, creo que Ulises lo dijo, de que algunos no creen, no creo que fue Paco, que Madrazo baje del 25, pues no es que crean, es que así sale. A los que le sale abajo del 25 son al Universal y al Reforma, son los que le baje. Pero nadie lo sube de 30, por ejemplo. O sea, ninguna encuesta lo está poniendo arriba del 30, es decir, es claramente el tercer lugar, es claramente el que en estos momentos tiene menos probabilidades de ganar. Por cierto, el Universal y el Reforma, al darle tan abajo a Madrazo, también son los que más arriba ponen a López Obrador. Son los únicos que lo ponen en 35 puntos. Todos los demás encuestadores están abajo del 35%, ¿no? Al haberle quitado tanto al Universal Reforma, les permite ser los que más alto dan a López Obrador. De hecho, si se fijan, la variación de los porcentajes de López Obrador es muy poca. O sea, está en 34 de promedio, pero quitando GEA, nadie está dos abajo ni dos arriba de ese 34 de promedio. O sea, sí está muy estable. Y lo único que varía es el Calderón y Madrazo. Si a Calderón lo ponen más arriba o más abajo, y si Madrazo más abajo. Esa es toda la variación. El porcentaje de López Obrador es muy estable en todas las encuestas. Vistas gráficamente están una en la línea de identidad sería el empate. Y entonces, ¿qué tan lejos de la línea de identidad, de qué tan cerrado? Entonces podemos encontrar que en general está cerca de la línea, salvo una encuesta, todas están un poco cerca de la línea de identidad. Así es como va la encuesta, pero todos los puntos están en el lado de arriba de la línea de identidad. Es decir, sí se podría afirmar que claramente, aunque fuera por un punto, si tuviéramos una encuesta de un punto, que alguien dijera, bueno, la probabilidad de que fuera empate es mucha, etcétera, pero la probabilidad de que 10 ejercicios repetidos nos dé un punto arriba el mismo ganador, se vuelve ya prácticamente un hecho de que sí va arriba. Entonces, podemos afirmar que Calderón va arriba en la encuesta hasta ese momento. Sí hay diferencias, y las variaciones, bueno, es nada más por cuántos puntos han ido variando. ¿Por qué? Vean nada más lo que voy a mostrarles. Este es el número de promocionales del monitoreo del IFE durante marzo. Esto es marzo. El que más promocionales reportes para López Obrador. No quiero entrar en detalles de dónde están los promocionales. Les digo, la mayoría de los promocionales de Calderón estaban en cadena nacional AAA y los de López Obrador estaban en locales. No. Pero sin entrar en detalles de eso, vean nada más de marzo a abril cómo cambia esta gráfica. En marzo, número de promocionales, y en abril, número de promocionales. O sea, López Obrador no nomás no va al debate, sino también se sale de los spots, de los promocionales. Vean el número de segundos medido por el IFE. Durante marzo, número de segundos que estuvieron al aire los spots, y vean en abril. Se sale también López Obrador. Entonces, López Obrador, su caída de abril no nomás se debe a que no fue el debate, pues tampoco fue a la tele, parece, ¿no? O sea, tampoco fue a los spots, tampoco fue en ausencia. Prácticamente se ausentó, no contestó, lo atacaron, no reaccionó. Entonces fue un poco en ausencia, lo cual ahora ya no está pasando. La semana anterior es la primera semana de la campaña donde el monitoreo que hace el periódico Universal reporta a López Obrador como el que más gastó en spots publicitarios. Entonces ya hubo una reacción del equipo, ya él también está con una negativa. Entonces, bueno, esta situación que vemos de marzo a abril ya nos está presentando ahorita. De hecho, ahorita López Obrador está muy en el aire, muy en los spots. Bueno, nomás es una estimación mía de participación electoral. Esta es la participación electoral que he observado en los procesos federales, como en los intermedios, 66, 57 y 42 son las elecciones intermedias. Estas son las elecciones de presidente. Entonces aquí, bueno, no sabemos quién va a ser cuál va a ser la participación. Bueno, mi estimación de participación es, primero observo cuál es la participación que han tenido las elecciones de gobernador que están actualmente en funciones. Los gobernadores actualmente en funciones tuvieron 54. Están gobernando con un 54 promedio de votos sobre el listado nominal. Entonces, lo primero que pienso es que va a ser mayor al 54. O sea, lo primero va a ser mayor al 54. Bueno, esa hipótesis se vale o no se vale. Entonces, me remito 6 años anterior. ¿Qué pasara si hoy estuviéramos en 2000 y estuviéramos analizando la participación de los 32 gobernadores que estuvieran en ese momento? Estuviéramos viendo un 58% de participación. Quiere decir que en el 2000 pasamos del 58 con que estaban los gobernadores al 64 en la elección presidencial, 6 puntos más. Si eso lo volviéramos a ver, estuviéramos hablando del 60% de participación. Bueno, tal vez sea mucho pensar en el 60. Si estuviéramos hablando del 60%, estuviéramos hablando de casi más de 42 millones de votos. Mi estimación es que va a haber al menos 40 millones de votos. Si hay 40 millones de votos, quiere decir que la participación va a estar sobre el 57%. Entonces, yo cuando me preguntan participación para omitir la desactualización del padrón electoral, lo que menciono siempre es en votos. Creo yo que 40 millones de votos son los que puede haber al menos. ¿Y por qué es importante? Porque entonces cada punto porcentual lo que equivale son a 400 mil votos. Y cuando estamos hablando de elección cerrada, más allá de los puntos, pensemos en votos. O sea, una elección de 3 puntos de diferencia es una elección de 1.200.000 votos de diferencia. Que 1.200.000 votos de diferencia, pues bueno, son 10 estadios aztecas llenos, ¿no? O no sé cómo lo quieran medir, pero es muchísima gente, 1 millón de gente. Entonces, la elección cerrada medida en votos. Simplemente el Congreso. Ese día, el 2 de julio, se eligen 1.431 puestos, 1.431 posiciones políticas. Hay electores que van a tener 6 boletas en su mano. Hay electores en Jalisco, en Guanajuato, en DF y en Morelos que van a tener 6 boletas en su mano. En otros estados, en otros 6 estados van a tener 5 boletas. La dinámica de la campaña en algunos lugares es más importante el alcalde que el presidente de la República. Y las campañas para alcalde apenas están iniciando. Entonces, la dinámica de la campaña va a modificarse en lo que falta, en los 38 días que faltan para la elección. Y entonces no podemos hablar nada. Los mexicanos van a estar expuestos. Imagínense simplemente que haya 5 candidatos por cada uno de los puestos. Hay más de 7,000 campañas en el aire. Y hay lugares en donde en cada poste hay 6 fotos, ¿no? Entonces, bueno, porque aquí está de locos, ¿no? O sea, en esos estados donde haya 6 boletas, en cada boleta 5 candidatos, entonces yo tengo 30 nombres que aprenderme para juzgarlos, es imposible para el ciudadano. Entonces la dinámica es distinta. Esta es la preferencia para presidente de la República y para diputados medir en abril. Entonces, ¿cómo vemos cómo en el caso del PRD la preferencia para presidente es claramente mayor que la preferencia para el partido, para diputado? En el caso del PRI es al revés. La preferencia para el partido es mucho mayor que la preferencia para el candidato. O sea, en otras palabras, podríamos decir que Madrazo le está quitando votos al partido y López Obrador le está dando votos a su partido, ¿no? O sea, son los dos. Calderón durante mucho tiempo fue empatado, pero el PAN ha levantado, o sea, la idea de que el PAN ha levantado. Pero bueno, se ganan diputados. Para los que no lo sepan, yo creo que de aquí ya, el haber venido los hace ya politólogos, creo que ya lo saben. La campaña, los diputados en México son 500 diputados. Son 2 carreras para los diputados. Una es la carrera por ganar 200 diputados y otra son los 300 distritos. Hay que ganar cada uno de los 300 distritos, pero además hay que ganar la repartición de los 200 diputados. Son 2 carreras, como quien dice. Entonces, a pesar de que el PAN lo traigo arriba, a la hora de hacer un posible escenario de cuántos diputados le quedarían a cada uno, me sale arriba el PRI. Es por una eficiencia de voto. El PAN ha crecido muchísimo en los 9 estados que ya gobierna. Eso lo hace tener más votos, pero no ganar más distritos. Ganan los mismos distritos. Entonces, no adelanta en la carrera de los 300, sino adelanta en la carrera de los 200. En cambio, el PRI, aún disminuyendo su número de votos, continúa ganando algunos distritos porque los había ganado claramente. Entonces, tiene una mayor eficiencia para ganar distritos, aunque en la repartición de los 200 le toquen menos. Sin embargo, lo que quiero hacer ver aquí es que están muy lejos de tener mayorías. Para tener mayoría se requiere tener 251 diputados o 65 senadores en la otra Cámara. Están muy lejos en este momento cualquier partido de tener mayorías, lo cual estamos que en abril, si esto, porque es abril, no habría una posibilidad fuerte de que un partido dominara ninguna de las cámaras. Es decir, nos vamos a ir otra vez a cámaras divididas. Nada más como la percepción de la preferencia electoral, cuando pregunto quién va arriba en las encuestas, está muy dividido. El 34% cree que va adelante Calderón y el 32% cree que va adelante López Obrador. Es decir, refleja lo que está pasando. Y cuando pregunto, ¿y quién cree que va a ganar? 31% dice Calderón. O sea, van empatados hasta en la percepción de que quién va a ganar. Es una elección competida, indefinida, interesante. Ahora, yo creo, a lo mejor es esperanza y credibilidad, en que no va a terminar cerrada. Eso es lo que yo creo, que no va a terminar cerrada. ¿Por qué? Porque faltan 38 días, y si hace 38 días pasó de un estado a hoy que está competida, no veo por qué hoy, para dentro de 38 días, se tenga que conservar exactamente igual. Va a haber cambio, lo que no sé es hacia dónde. En la última lámina nada más quería. En marzo, la confianza en instituciones. Y no le hagan mucho caso a todas, pero el tercer renglón. El tercer renglón es el Instituto Federal Electoral. La confianza en marzo en el Instituto Federal Electoral es alta. Es de las instituciones más confiables en México. Es el árbitro de la contienda electoral. Y el IFE, no los consejeros electorales, no las personas que están en el IFE. El IFE como institución es una de las instituciones más confiables de México. Equivalente a los maestros y solo abajo de la Iglesia y el Ejército. Entonces, bueno, yo creo que lo han lastimado últimamente, pero si logramos tener un IFE con alta credibilidad y alta confianza al final, creo que no va a haber ningún conflicto y que el 3 de julio estaremos simplemente comentando por qué ganó, por qué perdió, qué hizo, qué se equivocó, el efecto del segundo debate, el efecto del Mundial de Fútbol, el efecto de quién sabe qué cosas, pero estaremos comentando qué pasó y alguien estará hablando diciendo que fue inequitativa la contienda, pero tuvo más votos, etcétera, y estaremos simplemente viendo una elección interesante y contando la historia a los que pudimos vivirla. Pero no creo que vaya a haber un conflicto postelectoral. Gracias.
Rubén, muchísimas gracias. Y ahora con Rafael Jiménez.
Bueno, muchas gracias por la invitación. Yo también voy a hablar en español. Un poquito para que sea más fluida la presentación. Quisiera hablar de qué es lo que cambió en la campaña, además de la intención de voto, en el periodo de campaña. En el contexto original de la elección, ¿qué teníamos? Teníamos una ventaja de López Obrador durante más de 36 meses, en casi cualquier encuesta de opinión. Una vez que los partidos postularon candidatos, hacia noviembre, diciembre, cambió bastante la intención de voto, pero sobre todo en enero y febrero de 2006 tuvimos un periodo en el que López Obrador llegó a tener ventajas hasta de 10 puntos según algunas encuestas preelectorales. La mayoría de los ciudadanos creían que López Obrador iba a ganar en la elección. Los analistas, prácticamente todos los que escribían y comentaban, decían que iba a ganar López Obrador. Y tal vez más importante que eso, en todos los temas de interés para los ciudadanos, López Obrador tenía ventajas importantes o mayores que la intención de voto de las encuestas. Pero la segunda mitad de marzo, el contexto de la elección cambió. Primero quiero poner este nuevo contexto. Yo tengo una revisión más, un poquito más exhaustiva que lo que presentó Roy de las encuestas publicadas. Tengo aquí todas las que se han publicado desde mayo, desde inicios de mayo hasta la fecha. Incluyo dos o tres que no tenía Roy, ¿no? Marketing Político, que fue bastante exitoso en elecciones locales el año pasado. Telemundo, que publicó recientemente, y también Sogbi incluyo. Y en este caso el promedio de todas las encuestas que tengo aquí tienen a Felipe Calderón de 1 a 10 puntos en ventaja sobre López Obrador. El promedio de las encuestas está ahí abajo, es 38.3 Calderón, 24.1 Madrazo, 33.5 López Obrador. Y la variación sobre todo es grande en el caso del PRI, nada más de Madrazo. En todos los demás la variación es relativamente razonable dentro de márgenes de error de encuestas. Del rango de Calderón es 36 a 42, el de López Obrador 31 a 36, y efectivamente la mayor variación ocurre para medir a Madrazo. Aunque realmente las encuestas que tenían a Madrazo un poco más alto se concentran a los inicios de mayo, ¿no? Sobre todo. Otra forma de presentar aquí sí ya todas las encuestas publicadas, yo tengo 58 difundí, perdón, esta última, la de nosotros, no está publicada, sino estoy presentándoles aquí ese dato, ¿no? Una forma de verla completa, tomo de 250 días para acá, de 250 días a la elección para acá, y también vemos un poquito todo el movimiento global de la elección. Pero es una elección que no sigue una tendencia lineal, tiene sus puntos altos y bajos dependiendo del día en que se levante. Al final estamos viendo puntos en los que se concentran una serie de encuestas por aquí o por acá, ¿no? Se concentran bastantes encuestas que se publican. Me voy a lo del cambio de contexto. ¿Cómo López Obrador aventajaba en todos los temas? En temas de seguridad, dos temas concentran la atención de los ciudadanos. La problemática económica, principalmente empleo, pero en un sentido amplio las cuestiones económicas, y la seguridad, inseguridad en las ciudades sobre todo. Lo importante es que López Obrador en febrero tenía básicamente ventajas mayores incluso a las que sacaba en las encuestas de febrero. En seguridad tenía ventajas de 8 puntos, en economía, en empleo, por ejemplo, importantísimo, tenía ventaja de 8 puntos. No digamos el apoyo a los pobres, donde tenía 16 puntos de ventaja y de hecho aún sostiene ventajas en ese tema. Aún en corrupción, a pesar de los escándalos de algunos de sus colaboradores, seguía también con ventaja importante sobre Felipe Calderón. Pero ¿qué pasó en la campaña? Más allá de la primera caracterización de negativas o no, lo que cambió en principio es que Calderón empezó a ganar con fuerza el tema económico. Todas las preguntas de temática económica las empezó a sacar ventajas Calderón importantes. Eso es relevante porque la campaña de Calderón definió ahí la elección sobre todo a partir de marzo, de la primera quincena de marzo, logró llevar a ese terreno a buena parte de los electores, pero sobre todo a obtener grandes ventajas sobre López Obrador en temas como quién puede crear empleos, por ejemplo. Para mí el primer debate, lo que hace, los debates sí son importantes en muchas formas, pero sobre todo son como un principio de organización de la comunicación de las campañas. Antes y después del debate, los debates lo que ayudan es a reafirmar las líneas de comunicación que se están trazando en las campañas. Entonces ahí marco el primer debate, un punto muy importante para Felipe Calderón, para ya tomar una ventaja considerable en el tema de creación de empleos, fue alrededor precisamente del debate. Vemos que esa ventaja de López Obrador llegó a ser bastante grande, de 10 puntos en algún momento de febrero. Por ejemplo, en negativo, que es como una de las vertientes que se puede también preguntar. Este tema de la deuda, que también se relaciona mucho con otras preguntas sobre qué candidato puede llevar al país a una crisis económica. En este caso, había un problema al inicio de la elección. Madrazo tenía tan mala imagen que absorbía todo lo negativo que pudiera pasarle a México al inicio, ¿no? Era como una aspiradora de lo negativo, ¿no? Es decir, le robaba el oxígeno a las campañas y no dejaba que nadie advirtiera riesgos ni de Calderón o de López Obrador. Yo creo que lo importante de esa campaña de marzo es que mucha gente empezó a percibir riesgos de López Obrador al mismo nivel que Madrazo. Y digamos, él no logró colocar alguna idea en contra de eso, ni siquiera en estos últimos días, donde se ha aumentado ligeramente aquí este tema. De todas maneras, la ventaja de Calderón en el tema de quién puede llevar al país a una crisis económica, a una crisis de deuda, que fue como se fraseó en la campaña, es de 20 puntos sobre López Obrador. Para mí lo clarísimo es que estas ya son encuestas nuestras, completamente nuestras. Vimos que no tenían un sesgo mayor en relación a lo que estaban publicándose. ¿Qué es lo que pasa básicamente en los últimos meses y semanas? Esta sí llega ayer. A partir de marzo empezó las campañas ya con más intensidad, la segunda quincena de marzo. Hacia finales de marzo empezamos una encuesta diaria en domicilios, no telefónica, a diferencia de algunas telefónicas que se han difundido en México últimamente. Esta es domiciliaria, ciertamente para la campaña de Calderón. ¿Y qué es lo que vemos nosotros? Vemos que a partir de ese momento, sobre todo a partir de estos días previos al primer debate, Calderón ha tomado una ventaja bastante consistente a lo largo de las semanas recientes. Esta última ventaja es importante por lo que vamos a ver ahorita un poquito más. Esta es previa, ¿no? En temas económicos y en temas de seguridad, Calderón también está empezando a tomar alguna ventaja. Me regreso a esta. Esto lo vamos a empezar a relacionar algo más con la publicidad. ¿Y qué está pasando con la publicidad? Porque ahora hay un gran debate, una vez que el Tribunal Federal Electoral falló tomando la decisión de censurar varios anuncios, no todos, por cierto, ni siquiera todos los negativos, se vuelve un tema relevante a discutir también, ¿no? Quiero entrarle pues a ese asunto de los efectos de las campañas. ¿Qué pasa con las campañas negativas? ¿Qué es lo que podemos observar que está pasando con las campañas negativas? Cuando preguntamos en encuestas o grupos de enfoque a los ciudadanos qué les parecen las campañas de ataque, ¿no? Dicen que no les gustan, ¿no? Pero también algo que se conoce bastante bien en la literatura, se recuerdan mucho mejor que las campañas positivas. Hemos visto que funcionan las campañas negativas, que ofrecen más información sobre temas de lo que uno se imagina, que las campañas negativas llevan a que los ciudadanos discutan temas. O sea, el cambio de Calderón no fue en imagen, la relación Calderón-López Obrador no fue en imagen, fue en quién puede abordar mejor los temas sustanciales para los ciudadanos. Se perciben como más creativas que las positivas. De hecho, mucha gente no considera que sean negativas cuando ven una campaña de ataques. Los ciudadanos resisten anuncios en los que no creen. Los ciudadanos, si ven un anuncio negativo que no creen, y de hecho las campañas lo que hacen es probar una gran cantidad de anuncios, ¿no? Y vemos que hay unos anuncios de ataque que no tienen ninguna credibilidad para los ciudadanos y los resisten, y que incluso cuando están mal planteadas pueden rebotar al emisor, ¿sí? Es decir, los ciudadanos son capaces pues de procesar la información más allá de lo que el juez, en este caso el Tribunal Electoral, y con hipótesis equivocadas, cree. Para mi forma de ver, es muy importante mantener las garantías de libertad de expresión de los candidatos y los partidos, especialmente durante los periodos de campaña. Y particularmente porque en México hay condiciones más que mínimas de competencia. Ningún partido, ningún candidato está manco, pues, ¿no? Como ahorita vamos a ver con el caso del PRD. Y todos tienen oportunidad de defenderse. Hay división de poderes, hay fragmentación de poder en México considerable a nivel local, a nivel federal, legislativo con el Ejecutivo y el Judicial. Entonces, verdaderamente, menospreciar mucho la capacidad del ciudadano al pretender que las campañas negativas son manipuladoras o cosas de ese tipo, ¿no?
De hecho, son relativamente comunes las campañas negativas desde hace varios años. Desde 94 hemos visto campañas negativas en las elecciones presidenciales y en las locales hemos visto en prácticamente todos lados. ¿Qué diferencia hay de estas campañas a lo que ocurrió en el periodo del desafuero? La primera gran diferencia es que no hubo spots, no era un periodo de campañas, era un periodo de gobiernos. No había spots, por lo tanto, de televisión ni de radio ni nada de eso. Entonces, ciertamente era víctima de una injusticia López Obrador a los ojos de los ciudadanos, pero en campañas precisamente esperas eso, conocer más sobre los candidatos, sobre lo bueno y lo malo que pueden hacerlo como gobernantes. En las semanas más recientes, López Obrador ha lanzado una campaña a gran escala contra Felipe Calderón también, que lo sintetizo aquí tomando los puntos de rating de IVOPE, que es la medición de ratings en México, no lo de los monitoreos del Universal, sino los ratings de IVOPE, que se me hacen más precisos, ¿no? Vean lo que ha pasado del 17 de abril al 24, 1 de mayo y 8 de mayo, que ha sido un periodo de cambio importante otra vez en la compra de medios, ¿no? El PRI era el que más puntos de rating había comprado en el periodo de la semana que terminó el 17 de abril. El 24 de abril el PRI seguía teniendo un poco más que el PAN. El PRD en esta semana, cuando realmente creen las encuestas ya, ¿no?, hace una compra al doble de publicidad, y en la semana del 8 de mayo hace una compra al triple en relación al 24 de abril de publicidad nacional o de publicidad vista en las televisiones de los hogares de las personas. De hecho, las que siguen es más o menos igual a esto, es ligeramente mayor en las siguientes semanas. Y este es el ritmo de la campaña del PAN, que alcanza un pico en el 24 de abril y llega el 8 de mayo a esto, que se sostiene en la siguiente, que no lo pude anotar el día de ayer, ¿no? Y estas semanas están mucho más parejas PAN y PRD, ¿no? ya en lo que es el share of voice, más o menos lo que tenemos es este cambio, el PRD tomando más televisión pagada que PAN y PRI, es decir, hay condiciones de competencia perfectamente claras en México. En este mismo periodo electoral, ¿qué pasó con los anuncios? Los spots pasaron, es decir, este del 17 de abril en adelante, que es el que me interesa ahorita aquí abordar, y un poquito después podemos comentar el otro. Los spots de Calderón, de hecho, hay una cosa interesante, han sido más spots positivos que negativos contra la impresión de los analistas en México. Y curiosamente, la campaña más positiva es la de Madrazo, ¿no? 3 positivos por cada negativo tiene Madrazo, y no le sirvió mucho por lo que vimos en las láminas de los expositores previos. En cambio, Calderón tiene 46% de positivos por 54% de negativos, incluyendo a los que firman Calderón y el PAN. Y López Obrador tiene 45% de positivos por 55% de negativos, es decir, bastante negativas las dos campañas en este periodo de abril. Después de abril, pues de 7 de abril, del 1 de abril en adelante. Y también vemos que el impacto de las campañas aumentó fuertemente cuando se fueron más asuntos negativos. Este ya es con encuestas. Vemos como si hay un cambio en el escalón de las audiencias, de la gente que dice recordar algo sobre los spots políticos o de los candidatos. Y de hecho esto cambia bastante, ¿no? Por semana, de quién domina, digamos, el impacto en positivo, de qué candidato domina el impacto en positivo de las campañas. Aquí yo también hice un ejercicio similar al de Ulises. A mí me gusta también mucho más el efecto de las campañas en preguntas abiertas, de los que recuerdan las campañas. Y aquí está una cuestión fundamental de la campaña de Calderón. De cómo fue ganando, a pesar de que aparentemente no estaba eso para los ojos de los analistas, cómo fue ganando el asunto del empleo, ¿no?, que es trascendental en la campaña, conforme fueron avanzando las semanas, cómo la disciplina de comunicación de Calderón en el tema de empleo y los spots de empleo en positivo y en negativo, como puse ahí todos los temas económicos, fueron dándole una consistencia a la campaña de Calderón. Esta era la campaña que fue removida, digamos, en febrero o marzo, la de Manos Limpias, que tenía mucha recordación, pero poco impacto en imagen, en lo que ustedes quieran, en voto. Entonces, eso se quitó. Prácticamente este es efecto de la recordación de acá, porque esa desapareció hace mucho, la de Manos Limpias. Hubieron unos spots sobre debate, que también tuvieron algún efecto, y relativamente bajo la gente que recuerda a Calderón por los ataques a López Obrador, y el último es el de su eslogan, de su primer eslogan de Calderón, que también quedó ya hace mucho tiempo en el pasado, ¿no? De madrazo, no me detengo mucho porque Ulises ya lo dijo, lo recuerdan por ataques, por ataques, por ataques, y sin embargo tiene 3 veces más positivas que negativas. Entonces madrazo ya genera su mala imagen, el hándicap con el que empezó la elección, se refleja en todas las preguntas que se hagan de cualquier asunto. Entonces es la de enorme dificultad de madrazo. Y López Obrador, de hecho, en un buen momento estuvo con el tema de Chachalaca, que por cierto, aunque es un spot del PAN, es algo que efectivamente dijo López Obrador, y no solamente lo dijo, lo repitió, y no solo lo repitió, llevaba chachalacas a sus mítines, ¿no? O sea, Y cuando ya dijo que ya no lo iba a decir, lo volvía a decir, entonces no salía del asunto del chachalacas. Es decir, son campañas que reflejan algo real que estaba metido él. Y López Obrador ha debatido meses sobre asuntos como si se va a ir a vivir al Palacio Nacional o no. Ha estado en un montón, y en la pelea todos los días ha estado en sus declaraciones. Entonces él hace impacto de estas cosas también, ¿no? Ciertamente su segundo tema o en positivo ha tenido lo de apoyo a la gente, apoyo al pueblo, recortes de precios en algún momento que luego lo debilitó. El tema de la deuda, que fue una de las 2 líneas fundamentales, no fue chachalaca solo, fue el tema de la deuda. De hecho pasó de más impacto de 20 a 35, lo hemos visto cómo se ha sostenido, que López Obrador puede llevar al país una crisis o una deuda, a problemas por la deuda, pasó de 20 a 35, 20 antes de la campaña, 35 después de la campaña, y de ahí se ha sostenido en esos niveles. Pero al inicio no tenía ningún efecto electoral, de hecho madrazo sacaba ventaja en los que creían eso, que iba a endeudar o poner en crisis al país, y ahora tiene un impacto electoral bastante considerable este asunto. Esto es controlando por demás por efectos de demográficos, ¿no? Y en imagen no me voy a detener más, salvo que haya algo trascendental, que más que lo que han hecho los demás expositores. La buena imagen de Calderón se construyó por una buena primaria del PAN. Una buena elección primaria del PAN hizo que cambiara la imagen de Calderón, que se duplicara su conocimiento de nombre, un reconocimiento de los perdedores de un proceso bueno, mientras en el caso del PRI estaban teniendo un proceso terrible al mismo momento. Y de ahí la imagen de Calderón ha resistido incluso las 2 semanas de negativos que llevamos en México en este momento. Pero no fue en vacío, pues, la buena imagen de Calderón, ¿no? Ni fue nada más por spots, fue por las propuestas de empleo y por la buena primaria, ¿no? Ese es exactamente lo que cambió la imagen de Calderón, ¿no? En el caso de madrazo ya no me detengo porque ya es un abuso, ¿no? El tema, entonces, digo, todos han insistido en esto, ¿no? El infierno del que no sale, como dijo Ulises. Y López Obrador es muy interesante. De hecho, de López Obrador tenemos serie desde el primer día que entró al gobierno nosotros, ¿no? Pero pongo algunos puntos interesantes de cómo fue sosteniendo, cómo construyó una imagen considerablemente buena en su ejercicio de gobierno. Pero ciertamente nadie decía nada malo de él, ¿no? En el periodo de campañas, esto es lo que le pasó a López Obrador en el periodo de campañas, ¿no? Este es el arranque de las campañas reales, ya digamos, ¿no? No de las de presentación de enero y febrero, ¿no? Sino de las reales temáticas, etcétera, de segunda quincena de marzo en adelante. Luego, su negativa a debatir también le afectó, porque ya había pasado lo peor y vuelve a entrar en otro periodo malo cuando se niega a debatir. Y ahí están algunos efectos en algunas preguntas ya de confrontación. El candidato más intolerante es una variable que no era considerada importante antes, pero ahora algunos ciudadanos sí lo ven. Tiene Calderón ventaja de 23%. Básicamente me parece que es el lado de los candidatos. Quiero entrar un poquito a lo de Congreso, porque yo sí creo que va a cambiar en forma importante el panorama político de México en el Congreso. De entrada, los números de esto, ¿hay cierta divergencia en encuestas? A mí me parece que estos últimos datos se parecen más de nuestros datos a los que he visto, a los de BIMSA, que a los de Roy. Roy tiene muy cerrado, pero tiene ventajas del PAN. Pero están mucho más divididos, mucho más parejos PRD y PRI, ciertamente. Y el asunto de la regla, sobre todo me concentro en esta, la de diputados. Se necesitan aproximadamente 42% del total de votos nacionales y 167 distritos ganados para formar mayoría. Se necesitan las dos condiciones. A mi forma de ver, en una eventual victoria de López Obrador, que lograra repuntar estos puntos, pocos o muchos, pero que tiene de desventaja, es prácticamente imposible la mayoría de López Obrador, porque está concentrado en 5 o 6 estados prácticamente, y de hecho en 3 o 4 estados todo su diferencial. En cambio, Calderón tiene un poco más de probabilidad de lograr mayorías, porque tiene mucho más dispersión. Calderón está de líder en 150 y tantos, 160 distritos, mientras López Obrador en 60, ¿no? En este momento en encuestas distritales. Lo que sí es muy interesante es el efecto del debilitamiento del PRI. Y nada más les pongo un ejemplo de las encuestas distritales que hemos hecho en este último, ya con candidatos a diputados federales, en una región que no se ha mencionado mucho, pero que es densamente poblada, que es esta zona de Puebla, Tlaxcala, Veracruz, 3 estados, pongo, ¿no?, de encuestas distritales. Estos son los resultados del 2000. En el 2000, todavía en la victoria de Fox, el PRI ganó todos estos distritos. Están aquí las divisiones distritales. El PAN se concentró en unos cuantos zonas metropolitanas de esto. En Puebla le fue bien al PAN, pero en Tlaxcala ganó el PRI. Así, con los números más o menos similares a los que hemos visto de todos los encuestadores, ¿qué pasa en esta misma región en este momento? Hace una semana que terminamos esta encuesta. Pasa un cambio importante en la elección de diputados federales con nombres de candidatos, etcétera. Claro, están en campaña, pero ya es con esto, ¿no? Vemos que prácticamente en la gran mayoría de estos distritos pierde el PRI. O sea, gana el PRD varios de ellos, importantes. El PAN se lleva toda la región de Puebla, Tlaxcala. Y se lleva buenas porciones de Veracruz, del centro de Veracruz y del norte, mientras el PRI solo retendría 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 15 distritos, pero en una región donde hay 40 distritos y donde el PRI había ganado 35 distritos, ¿sí?, en el 2000. Entonces, yo no creo que el modelo de Roy no estaba basado en datos distritales, sino en algo más genérico, y yo sí, ya a nivel tierra, digamos, yo sí creo que va a haber un cambio importante en el panorama político de México. Pase lo que pase, gane López Obrador o gane Calderón en el Congreso, sobre todo, ¿no? ¿Qué veo para cerrar esto? Veo una elección que entró en una dinámica nueva de competencia. Después de los 36 meses de López Obrador, Calderón es el nuevo líder. Yo creo que eso es básicamente, es claro, ¿no? Y ha aguantado, porque tenemos datos al día de ayer, aquí ha aguantado el ataque fuerte de López Obrador de estas últimas 2-3 semanas. Hay algunos efectos, pero no en la intención de voto sustancial, no para cambiar el líder, digamos, ¿no? De todas maneras, tenemos que estar cuidadosos con esta afirmación. ¿Por qué? Porque ha habido importantes efectos de campaña. Tenemos la experiencia del 2000, que lo hubo. Entonces, tenemos que estar claros, y sobre todo por una variable, aparte de los efectos de campaña, que es la debilidad del PRI. La debilidad del PRI ha provocado que esta elección sea un poco más impredecible que otras, ¿no? Realmente estamos viendo un escenario de destrucción importante de buena parte de la base del PRI, de los líderes principales del PRI llamando a votar hoy Barlet por López Obrador. En las semanas previas, gente como Luis Téllez, Deodoro Carrasco, etcétera, gente importante del PRI, Jesús Reyes Heroles, que llamando a votar por Calderón. Es decir, es a nivel élite y a nivel tierra el problema que tiene el PRI. Entonces, ciertamente creo yo que esa debilidad del PRI hace que sea más impredecible la elección de la cuenta. La de mayoría en el Congreso será algo muy, muy difícil de lograr, a pesar de que Calderón tiene un poco más de probabilidad, bastante más probabilidad que López Obrador. Es muy probable que se necesiten coaliciones, gane quien gane, ¿no?, de pedazos del PRI o de otros partidos, ¿no? Y me parece que esto va a ser así independientemente de quién gane la elección. Yo dejaría aquí la presentación del panorama de lo que vemos hacia adelante. Me parece que lo importante ahorita es que Calderón ha resistido 2 semanas de ataques a gran escala de compra de medios de López Obrador. Eso sería todo.
Bueno, ¿qué ibas a comentar? No. Ok. Rafael, muchísimas gracias. Son las 11:10 aproximadamente. Me gustaría que hubiera quizá un intercambio entre los encuestadores, pero también no tenemos mucho tiempo para preguntas y respuestas. Entonces creo que vamos a, ya si hay algún punto en específico que en el curso de preguntas y respuestas quieren ellos comentar entre ellos, lo podemos hacer, pero creo que sería importante abrir la sesión a preguntas y respuestas. Les pido que se esperen antes de hacer la pregunta, que se esperen al micrófono, porque el evento sí lo estamos traduciendo para quienes no entienden un o el otro idioma. También les pido que se identifiquen. Kristen, are you the only one working the phones, the microphones? And Danilo. Well, why don't we open it up for a Q&A and comments, and hopefully an interactive session, and take advantage of the fact that we have them here. We'll start off with Manuel.
¿Lo quieres en inglés o en español?
Yo prefiero que tú hagas la pregunta en inglés.
Okay. Fine. Manuel Suárez Mier, American University. I want to congratulate all of you for a marvelous presentation. I think it's very useful. I have 2 questions. No one knows the industry of poll making as you do. Now, would you please address the issue of López Obrador claiming that he has this poll that gives him a consistent 10-point advantage? And the second question is, how do you think the recently announced alliance of the PRD and the PRI to reject the results of the election if Calderón wins will affect public opinion and eventually the results of what's going on? Thank you.
No sé si quién quiere.
O varias.
¿Varias quieren? Okay. Kirsten, I think in the back, if you can lift your hand up so that we can, and maybe one of you can stand in the back and one of you can stand in the front so that we can kind of.
Hi, I'm Kirsten Cole from the Tinker Foundation. I have some questions sort of about about the polling industry or business itself. One question I have is, to what extent are polls shaping public opinion in addition to sort of reflecting it or describing public opinion? And my other question is, in terms of polling itself, what do you see as sort of where it's going? I mean, it's a relatively new phenomenon in Mexico, so I'm curious as to sort of what you see as its future, where it's going. Anyway, thank you.
Kirsten, thank you very much. The gentleman over here.
Good morning. My name is Mario Mitre with the National Democratic Institute. Some of you had slides on intolerance and perception of intolerance, and you also mentioned that there is going to be necessary to have a coalition in Mexico in Congress because it's very probable that no one is going to have majority. Do you guys have any information or have you polled perception of which candidate is more likely to be able to form those coalitions and be able to govern effectively?
Okay. Why don't we just answer these 3 sets of questions first before we go to the second round? I don't know who wants to tackle. ¿Quién quiere sobre las encuestas y el claim.
A ver, en español voy a hablar, perdón, nuevamente. La primera pregunta, la de Manuel, tiene algo de crítica y algo de pregunta, ¿no? O sea, la pregunta es cómo que es posible que López Obrador diga que tiene una encuesta que va 10 puntos arriba permanentemente. Bueno, yo lo que pienso simplemente es que es un discurso de campaña, es un discurso de decir no acepto ir abajo, no acepto. La última vez incluso que le preguntaron al aire sobre mi encuesta, no la descalificó, pero criticó la metodología. O sea, es no aceptar que va abajo simplemente. Aunque sí creo que sí tiene sus encuestas. O sea, sí tiene sus encuestas que van más allá de las empresas encuestadoras. Él está haciendo su propia encuesta con su metodología. Yo creo que el discurso de decir que tiene una encuesta 10 puntos arriba es simplemente decir no quiero aceptar que no voy arriba. Es nada más. Es una forma de decirlo. Sobre la pregunta, es muy interesante la pregunta del futuro de las encuestas. No es un fenómeno nuevo en México, las encuestas no son un fenómeno. De hecho, ahorita que Rafael Jiménez decía que llevaba 57, yo en el 2000 conté 187 encuestas. O sea, hubo más encuestas en 2000 que de las que hoy hay. No más que en 2000 eran encuestas, no eran reales, o sea, eran números. Había muchos números, pero no eran reales las encuestas. Hoy, toda encuesta que no va acompañada de la defensa de un rostro y una voz que la defienda, la justifique, la explique, no es considerada en cuenta por los medios. Entonces, el nuevo fenómeno que se está dando no es la presencia de las encuestas, sino la presencia de los encuestadores defendiendo sus encuestas. Esa es la nueva presencia, es el nuevo fenómeno. Ahora, ¿cuál va a ser el futuro? Como se ve, no así que digas que qué bien nos va a ir, no, nos va a ir muy bien porque este gremio ha sido, al ser tan expuestos los encuestadores, al estar tan expuestos, también hemos sido atacados personalmente, ha habido desplegados, spots donde nos atacan. Entonces, de alguna manera vamos a terminar como terminan los políticos las campañas. O sea, no todos ganan. Entonces, aquí también va a haber un fenómeno. Yo creo que las encuestas sí jugar un papel predominante, vamos a tener que explicar los porqués de lo que pasa, vamos a tener que contar la historia, y resulta que no todos estamos contando la misma historia, es un poco lo que está pasando, no todos estamos siguiendo la misma serie, las mismas trayectorias. Entonces, bueno, ¿cuál es el futuro? Pues depende también de cómo nos vaya, cómo logremos salir, cómo logremos explicar. Lo que sí es un hecho es que ya es imposible, igual que en cualquier lugar del mundo, es imposible pensar en una elección importante sin la presencia de encuestas que estén contando la historia. Entonces vamos a estar presentes, pero a título, yo creo que van a aparecer nuevas, se van a regionalizar, va a haber encuestas en los estados, va a haber nuevas metodologías de hacer encuestas. Sí, es un con futuro, pero en este proceso particularmente vamos a tener que salir después del 2 de julio a pues a entregar cuentas de lo que hicimos.
Regarding the alliance, the convergence of PRI and PRD in criticizing President Fox about the state election as they claim it. I think that this depends on several factors. Who knows about it? And those who know it, if they really believe that this is going to be true. But assuming that this happens, that, for instance, there is a campaign, and then the people find out that there will be this convergence between PRI and PRD. And I think that we can think about two likely outcomes or where public opinion could head. I think that one possible consequence that could benefit AMLO and could affect Calderón would be that if Madrasistas, if Priistas believe that the PRD is closer to the position of Madrazo, then the second preference of Madrasistas would probably move. Right now, Calderón is the second preference of Madrasistas, and indeed, insofar as there is a decline of support for Madrazo, you would think that Calderón would benefit the most because of this change. One of the consequences of the negative campaign was that because of risk aversion of PRI voters, they are now closer to Calderón than to López Obrador, which is a reversal of what happened in the previous months. So one consequence would be that this would probably move Madrasistas closer to López Obrador than to Calderón. This could help. But I think that the impact would be very slim because Madrasistas are more or less divided to some extent between Calderón and Madras, although the advantage is in Calderón's side. But I think that the most important consequence of this is that if people find out or if this becomes an issue, that this would influence the attitudes of independent voters. And independent voters do not like the PRI. And the good position or the relative good position that López Obrador has in the polls is because independent voters are somewhat fond of him. And I think that if this becomes an issue, this would affect independent support for López Obrador, so it would work against López Obrador in the polls. The other thing that I want to talk about is to what extent polls shape public opinion. I think that this is a very hot topic usually. In Mexico, we do not have a definitive experiment, because I think that we need experiments to see the real the impact of polls on public opinion. But the evidence that we have is that the impact is really, really small. And indeed, I'm really surprised because you saw some of the poll results that show that many people believe that about 22%, according to Rawls' figures, mine are 25%. 1 out of 4 voters believe that Madrazo is going to win. But no poll gives Madrazo in first place. So that gives you an idea that what is the credibility of polls in shaping public opinion in Mexico. I think that it's really small. People tend to believe information that reinforces their political preferences or their values. And even though if they were going to give credibility to polls' figures, what you have right now because of López Obrador's statements is that people would probably not would not know what to believe. I think that periodistas would tend to believe what López Obrador is saying, that he's ahead of the polls, and then obviously you have all the other polls showing that Calderón is ahead. But there is conflicting information, and that's one of the reasons why right now the state of polling in Mexico is that polls are used as propaganda. So in order to avoid any possibility that polls influence public opinion, in some cases, poll figures have been invented, or as López Obrador claims, he's ahead. So I think, in short, that the impact is very, very slim.
Rapidly about the pre-PRD last statement, it's very sad, and I am very worried about it, because in the end, the elections is a competition between parties. And if government doesn't intervene at all, it's better. And to happen, it means that one of the losers has to raise the hand of the winner. And I don't know what the effect could have in the campaign, but in the long run, it's very sad to expect that the PRI will not raise the hand of Calderón if he wins the election. So we can force. That is what he announced. That is what it means, he said. That's it. I will run with López Obrador. It has a lot to do with the way the president has behaved. He's been very active. And so that's worrisome, and we should look at it carefully. And let's hope that this thing changes, because we Mexicans have spent billions of dollars in building up an electoral system with credibility. It's very sad that it could happen. So I hope this changes and somebody raises the winner as it should be. It is not the announcement of the authority who gives credibility to the political to election. It is the acknowledgement of among gentlemen and ladies that gives credibility to electoral process. And this is at this point something that probably won't happen in Mexico. Polls shaping public opinion, I don't know if they do, but as I said, polls change strategies of political parties, and what shapes public opinion is political communication. So they do have now in this campaign in particular, the polls have been very, very important in the way political campaign teams have been designing his strategy, so it has a lot of future of polls. I am more optimistic. Everywhere polls are bad in elections.
Everybody wants to know who's ahead. Everybody wants to read polls, but everybody criticizes them. And in the end, there are hundreds of articles about who did well and who did wrong. The Mexican polling industry is a very good industry. It's mature. It is very good, technically speaking, and it has margins of error within the standards that you can find anywhere else. So that's I don't see a problem. Now, the most important thing I would like to say. In 1990, the first important political reform was that no party can change the constitution alone. That is, the reform put a ceiling to the number of deputies that a party can have in Congress. It was 60%. And to amend the constitution, you need 60% of the chamber. So, 66% of the chambers. And that meant that all these reforms that took place between 1990 and today had to be agreed and have to come from a coalition among parties. The governing coalition between 1990 and 2000 was, was the pre- and pan-coalition who came together to all the transformations that took place in Mexico in those years. So coalition is a necessity in Mexico as in anywhere else. Now, divided government meant that it's now it is not only constitutions that you have to coalesce and join in coalitions to transform, but also the laws, regular laws, no regular things, no? So coalition is necessary, is a must for every democratic systems. With divided government after 1997, the most important transformation of the rescue of the financial system was done with a divided government. The PRI didn't have a majority in Congress, and the reform took place. So I hope that as a result of this election, the conditions for collaboration within party caucuses in Congress is rebuilt, and we start making the changes that the country needs. But to be very honest, I'm not sure that will happen. So maybe we will have another 3 years or maybe six of limited cooperation within political fractions.
Just quickly, I'm not sure that what's going on in Mexico now with polls is something that is happening just in Mexico. I think the general debate in the world about the accuracy, the importance of surveys in every election is, I think, everywhere. Last week we were in Montreal in the World Conference for Public Opinion, and at least a couple of panels was about the problem of polls in the U.S., the idea that maybe in the last election there are some doubts because the exit polls were not accurate, and they gave some some of them gave as a winner John Kerry. And what is, I think, difficult in Mexico now about what we do is that the expectation of being accurate in a close election is something difficult to deal with. If you refer that to what happened here in the last presidential election, you have a group of polls saying that Kerry was ahead by 2 or 3 points, another group of polls saying that Bush was ahead for 2 or 3 points. At the end, the information was it's a close election. It doesn't matter who is going to win. It's a close election, and that happened. We're in the same circumstance. The problem is that with this type of election, with our margin of errors, a polls with 1,000 cases, 1,500 cases, or even a polls with 10,000 cases cannot predict in a way what's going to happen. So what we're saying is that most probably is going to be a tight election, maybe between two candidates. No, and the third one is not a player. That's actually a lot of information, but the public is expecting from us to give. They want us to give them the winner, and maybe what it's difficult to say now in Mexico is that, well, we're just saying that it's tight, and that should be enough in terms of information. in our advantage is the fact that, in general, we have a problem with pre-electoral polls, because given the law as it is today, we cannot publish until a week before the election. And for methodological problems, we have to do just households, and we have to, most of us, we conduct surveys during weekends and not during weekdays. And that means that we have to poll, or we have to conduct our surveys 2 weeks before the election, so we can publish 1 week before the election. And what people think is that what we publish 1 week before is going to predict what's going to happen the week after. So it doesn't matter if we're in May and we cannot predict what's going to happen in July. But even in June, the last polls that we are going to conduct are going to be conducted mid-June. And in 50 days, many things can happen. So that's another problem. First, the idea that we predict. Second, the fact that we have to go 2 weeks before the election happened. So that's something that it's in the law. That's something that we cannot change. Where I think we have established a good reputation, and basically Roy knows more about this, it's on exit polls. On exit polls, I think most of our experiences, we have been extremely accurate, even with exit polls, not with quick counts. Maybe our pre-electoral polls were not that accurate, but exit polls have been very accurate in 2000 and 2003, and in a way that has reestablished the reputation of the industry. Just finally, two words about the numbers that Roy and Rafael presented. So something that has not been taken into account about the distribution of the Congress is that even if the TRI in coalitions can win the majority of the seats, with the number of seats that they have to give to the Partido Verde, they might not end up being the majority. Actually, the probability that the PAN represents the majority of the Congress, I think, is there even with those numbers. Because if you discount the number of seats that the PRI has to give to the Partido Verde, which is, I don't know, a number maybe 20 or something like that, most probably, even when it's the most efficient party, they are not going to have. They are not going to be the first minority in the Congress.
Quick answer into that. I really think that PRI is not an efficient party anymore in this election. It's a very regional party. They have dropped 20 to 25% by regions, and they are going to lose a lot of elections, local elections, federal elections, or in districts. They are going to lose a lot. Besides, they have to give. Of their total percent, they have to give, if they got 30%, let's say that's a very reasonable number for the coalition of PRI, 6% of those are green party candidates or seats. So it all depends on how weak PRI ends after this election. And another thing, I think... Fox's experience into this of how to deal with Congress has showed both Calderón and López Obrador that they have to go after that immediately. They have to build a coalition in Congress very early, right after they win the election. And it all depends on how weak PRI ends, but that by now it seems to be that they are going to end very weak after this election.
It's very important that the next president's party has at least one third of the Chamber of Deputies or in Congress in general, because in that way it can sustain his presidential veto. Otherwise, things will get rougher.
Okay, I actually have a question and perhaps a comment. In the case of the PRI, at least I've noticed a difference of opinion at the table. Roy tends to think that the PRI will have more of a presence, and Rafael tends to think that the PRI will not be much of a force as a result. I have my own perspective that if we look at the PRI during the last 6 years, there's no question that there's been a very divided PRI. One of the things that we've been seeing with the way Roberto Madrazo has steered the selection of candidates is that pretty much he hasn't really shared the pie, and that if anything, we're going to see a PRI that may have been weakened electorally for not having captured the presidency, but will actually be a much stronger party from a cohesiveness point of view, given that the fact that maybe he is weeding out some of the divisions within the party. And ultimately, as I was telling Paco earlier today, could end up evolving to be, in essence, the leader of the PRI faction in Congress. In other words, he would ultimately be the one who ends up pulling the strings. Is this perspective accurate? Because everybody has discounted Roberto Madrazo, and I agree. I'm not convinced that Roberto Madrazo is actually running for president. He's actually running for the control of the PRI, and he's running for the leadership of the PRI faction in Congress. And so while everybody's discounting Roberto Madrazo, I think he discounted himself a long time ago. And he's going to be the one, he's going to be a principal power broker in 2006 to 2009. Am I off base? That's my question.
¿En el mismo orden?
Sí.
Bien, a ver, yo coincido. Yo, de hecho, hasta el final me voy a ir diciendo que Madrazo puede ganar la presidencia, aunque coincido que es muy poco probable, ¿no? O sea, tenemos que asignarle, pues, existe mientras esté en la contienda y sea el PRI, o sea, porque el PRI pues, no tiene posibilidades, aunque es poco probable. Efectivamente, es un candidato rechazado, es un candidato que es muy difícil construir imagen. Bien. Gobierna 17 entidades el PRI, y cada uno de esos 17 gobernadores está interesado en ganar su elección. Ante un escenario de tener un presidente de oposición, su única la negociación de los gobernadores con el presidente son los diputados que pueda tener en el Congreso. Entonces, allí sí existe la posibilidad. El PRI es un partido importante, ¿no? Yo no lo veo. Cuando decimos que si pensamos que se está de abajo o no, no es que pensamos, es que la encuesta nos genera ese dato. Pero si ya tratamos de hacer algo de proyección, yo no veo un desplome del PRI como partido. Sí pocas posibilidades de Madrazo para ganar, pero no un desplome del PRI. O sea, el PRI va a seguir teniendo fuerzas regionales, va a ser el más fuerte en muchos distritos, en muchos estados, en muchos municipios, va a seguir siendo la fuerza predominante. Lugares en donde el ciudadano ni siquiera piensa en la posibilidad de votar por otro partido, o sea, son el PRI. Sin mencionar estados, hay un estado en donde el lema de campaña es: este PRI sí sabe gobernar, ¿no? O sea, como diciendo, no somos el PRI, no somos el otro, este PRI sí sabe gobernar, donde las campañas son locales. Entonces, bueno, yo no veo un desplome del PRI nada más porque sí. Coincido en que una cosa es la carrera presidencial y que tal vez Madrazo esté jugando a mantener el Congreso.
First, the PRI has already lost a lot of support. I mean, if you put the PRI support right now at 28%, that means it has lost one third of the votes that the PRI and the Green Party Alliance had in 2003. So 28% of the vote is really a low estimate in historical standards for the PRI. Putting the PRI at 25, 22, I think that it's really important that we know what happened or to have an accurate estimation, because if you look at the polls, there is a consensus about where López Obrador stands, between 32 and 34%. But then, if you have the PRI very low, you also have Felipe Calderón very high. So if you don't have a more or less accurate estimation of the PRI, then it's going to affect your estimation of Calderón. So
I think that's why it's really critical to have an accurate measurement of the PRI strength. But why the PRI has lost a lot of support? I think that the PRI is the Mexican version of the Democratic Party in the U.S. It's very strong at the local level, but very weak at the national level. And this has to do a lot with the way that the national leadership of the PRI is structured. While at the local level you have new PRI politicians, very young, different, at the national level you have the old guard. And I think this is going to be very critical in terms of structuring the composition of the PRI seats in Congress. Because if you think about the single-member districts, the single-member districts in the states that are governed by the PRI, most of those seats were more or less decided by the governors. Roberto Madrazo, the national leadership, has had more leeway on the states where the PRI was opposition. But those states, the PRI had a lot of trouble with the nomination. There were a lot of, how do you say, impugnar?
Controversies were disputed.
Those nominations were disputed even in the Federal Electoral Tribunal. But more importantly, those are states where the PRI has lost a lot of support in the recent 2 years. In 2003, states where the PRI is no government at the local level gave the PRI about 40% of the votes. That's no longer the case. So I think that at least regarding single-member districts, those states where Madrazo had a lot of to say about the nominations are states where the PRI is not going to win the single lot of seats. Regarding the PRI seats, Madrazo had a lot of leverage there, but it has to give a good chunk of seats to the Green Party. So I'm not sure about after this, how will Madrazo loses or the PRI gets 27% of the votes. It has to give at least 6.6% of the votes to the Green Party. And for instance, in the Senate, if I'm correct, the PRI will get by proportional representation about 12 seats, between 10 and 12 seats. And 4 out of the first 10 seats will go to the Green Party. So I think that Madrazo will have to play this very old strategy of divide and conquer with the PRI governors, because I don't think that by himself he will have enough number of seats in Congress, even if he loses, and even if he's trying to control the PRI right now or afterwards.
Okay.
Very rapid, just an addition to this that you probably should keep in mind, and the issue of coalition is whether or not the caucuses, the fractions of each party in Congress, in the House or in the Senate, vote together or not. Another way to build up coalition is with fractions of parties, and it happens here very often. I mean, it is not in Mexico has happened, but very not that much in the House. That is to say, the coalition of the party remains voting together. The only time that it was almost a reform almost passed without a divided vote within the fraction of the PRI was the value-added tax initiative that was sure to be passed because some of the party of the deputies of PRI were willing to vote in favor. So now it hasn't happened that much in Mexico yet, and I think it has to do with the fact that we don't have open primaries and re-election, in which the diputados have a 3-year period and depend on their the whoever sent them there to for his future career in a political career, and then the governors are very important in this because they would be probably were the ones who put most of the people in Senate. By the contrary, since this period there was a lot of Priistas voting differently in the Senate. No? So whether or not the PRI is a very important party for sure, and it's the only way to get a coalition will be pulling together a majority of deputies and
I don't see a situation in which the PRD can come together with PRI or PAN to vote these reforms in the sense that many of us think that have to be done, modernizing, open the economic sector such as energy, telecommunications, and so on. So the importance of the PRI will be seen, and it will be very much in the next year, regardless of Madrazo's future, which I don't think is too wide.
Okay. Why don't we go out to see if there are any more questions? I mean, we only have a few more minutes left, and so I'll take three questions, if you can make them concise. Four questions. Steve, Sergio, and then the two gentlemen here. And if we can also make the answers concise as well, given the amount of time.
Steve Chaplin, Foreign Service Institute, Department of State. I'm wondering, in the results you have in terms of presidential candidate preferences and also attitudes on major issues such as crime, the economy, jobs, drugs, and so forth, do you have a breakdown by gender and by youth, or by, say, under 25 voters at all?
Okay. And we're just going to take several of them. Danilo, the gentleman said you right there.
My question is, could a potential congressional agreement here on undocumented migration have an impact on the general election? And if so, who could potentially benefit one party versus the other? Thank you.
Okay. Over here is Tom.
Eric Rojo, U.S. Mexico Chamber of Commerce. First of all, thank you for such a coalition of diverse and very interesting thinking. It was a great education. But a question that doesn't seem to appear, the presidential vote in Mexico is popular vote. Nevertheless, all of you did not choose to address population density, population distribution, urban, rural. It talks more about a more federal republic. You talk about the power of the states. My question is, why is the popular vote appears not to be a factor in your polling? Thank you.
Do we still have time? Okay. Just specifically on the energy sector, I'm Jaime Brito with PFC Energy. I know that for energy reform to happen in Mexico, a lot of political forces need to work on the Congress and all that. I am aware of the importance of the diputados and senators and all that. But have you done any exercise that shows the preference of the general public in terms of private investors, either foreign or national, participating in the energy sector? Is still this taboo valid about petróleo es de los mexicanos, or has something changed?
Okay. Thank you.
Well, just briefly coming back about the PRI and the importance, I think something that we have to take into account for this election is that there are 10 local elections for Congress happening at the same time with this presidential election. So most of the governors, most of the PRIista governors are in the dilemma of what to do. Let's talk about two examples. The governor of Sonora, Burs, or the governor of Nuevo León, they might not like Madrazo, but they need people in the federal Congress, and they need their Congress, and they have local elections as well. So even when they don't want to support Madrazo, they have to support the party because they need people in the federal Congress and they need, once again, control in their own Congress. So I'm not sure, and in this is a matter of interpretation, if Madrazo is going to be that powerful, because what Jorge said previously, I think is very true, is most of the governors decide on their on the seat, well, those who have control of their states, which is actually half of the country, 15, 16 states, they decided on most of those seats. Madrazo decided on those the seats of those states where the PRI is not governing, is not, and maybe in those seats for the party seats, the diputados de mayoría. So if this number, if ends up happening, what we are seeing here, that the difference between the party and Madrazo is between 6 to 8 points, we're talking about a difference of maybe 3 or 4 million of votes with a participation of 60%, which I think might be a scandal under any circumstance, which was something that actually happened to La Bastida, but the difference was not that large. So I'm not sure if Madrazo is going to be that powerful, at least in the eyes of the public. He might be a very good political operator behind the scenes, but I'm not sure if he's going to be actually the leader of the PRI after this election. But that's and so something very important about the next the way the next Congress might work, which I think it's necessary to point out, is that with López Obrador or with Calderón, I think there is going to be more political operation. Some members of the team of López Obrador, which are very close to Calderón, to Camacho, for example, they argue that they might operate with the Congress with 180 congressmen, and they can build the coalitions they need. In the case of Calderón, after all, his career as a congressman is a very important part of his curriculum, so he knows very well how to operate. So personally, both teams have a better experience dealing with the Congress and how to build coalitions in order to change public policy, which I think can represent a very important difference compared with the previous Congress. Finally, we don't have gender gap. I mean, there is no election yet in Mexico which can be or has been decided with the vote of women. I think in most of our polls, maybe there are some differences here or some nuances, but I think it's difficult to explain this election by groups. If the youth is going to give the victory to one of these candidates, maybe the elderly is one of those segments which is more in favor of López Obrador. But we are in a very ideological election with differences in more in terms of attitude towards the candidate or being, people believing fear is the poor or Mano Firme, Pasión por México, which is actually something more ideological. But I think we cannot identify yet very important groups, the rural vote versus urban vote. For example, something very different now compared with 6 years ago is that PAN has the same level of party ID in rural areas compared with the urban areas, which is something amazing. I mean, if someone would have said that 6 years ago, maybe it was an impossible scenario. Now it's happening, based on all these programs, Oportunidades, Vivienda. So I think, at least for us, and I think pretty much is true for this table, it has been very difficult to identify specific groups based in sociodemographics. I think it's possible to identify those in attitudes and opinions towards the candidates and the parties.
Demographics are less important in this election, as Francisco said, but maybe there are a couple of them that are important. If we use the marketing way of grouping population by 20 to 25 different variables of how they live, we can see that middle classes are going more with Calderón, middle and upper classes, and the middle down, it's very tight. It's a very tight election in the middle down. The poor still has a little more of advantage. López Obrador has a impact in every one of these groups. Economic voting, I think it's important, but it's very divided, the perception of how well is the economy going in Mexico. So it's very it's a very divided issue. If people believe they are better, they are going to vote for Calderón very clearly. But it's a very divided perception in this moment. And the immigration agreement effect. It was a policy that Vicente Fox compromised a lot in Mexico. But I don't think if that doesn't happen as in Mexico is expected or the way that Mexico would like, I don't think that will punish a lot Pan or Fox. If it goes well for Mexico, I think it can help a little more the approval of Fox, maybe. In that way, we can think that it could have a little impact, but not as much as.
I'm just going to kind of elaborate a little bit more on Rafael's answer for Sergio. I mean, clearly, you know, it all depends on what the immigration reform looks like. If at the end of the day, the House initiative prevails and we have a security-centric initiative, clearly, you know, obviously Fox doesn't win, and both the PRI and the PRD will try to pin the tail on the PAN donkey. If you end up with an initiative that is balanced and has a temporary worker program, some type of earned regularization, obviously with balance on security, Fox will definitely try to hail a victory, and I'm assuming that Felipe will try to do everything possible to get on the bandwagon and claim some type of credit, at least from a partisan continuity standpoint. But to tell you the truth, who wins and who loses, it really depends on what the end product is, if there is one, coming out of Congress before the July election. I think with that, I actually have had a lot of fun. I consider myself, you know, a very fortunate person because not only am I a student, but I also get, in a lot of ways, to select my curriculum, being the director of the Mexico Project. And I get to select, in a lot of ways, the people that come up and the issues that I think are relevant. And so I'm very fortunate professionally, and I think given the results of today's session, I think it was very, very useful. I learned a lot. I think there was a lot of information that was presented, and Kirsten is trying to get some attention, and so I think I'll acknowledge her. She's down here from New York from the Tinker Foundation, and this event was partly a result of their funding for Mexican elections, and I'm very grateful to Tinker and to Kirsten as well, and for their support. And I obviously want to thank all of our guests because they did fly up for this event, and then some of them actually go to the airport from here. So I want you all to join me in thanking them for making the time to come up and be here with us. Okay. Well, thank you very much.